Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands.
Alright, alright, alright. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. That's one artist, three songs. Get your request in now. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Hey, coming up in just a few minutes here, our good friend Dan Feinberg is going to join us to talk TV. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us biweekly, and it's time for his visit this morning. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Lots of TV to talk about with Dan. There always is, and we'll get to that. Always a lot of fun talking TV with him, and we'll do that in just a few minutes. So this weekend, It Chapter 2 opens. It's one of the more anticipated movies of the year, and a sequel to a very effective and really cool horror film from a couple of years ago called It, and a continuation of the Stephen King, giant Stephen King novel. So in honor of a really big horror movie being released this weekend, we're going to talk about some of the fascinating facts about your favorite horror movies. Some really fascinating facts about your favorite horror movies, things you probably didn't even know. So we'll talk about that. And also the most terrifying horror books ever. So we're going to talk about scary books, scary movies in honor of It Chapter 2. Which is opening on Friday. Well, technically tonight it opens. There you go. If you would like to join us for any of these topics or anything else, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for talk or text and for your Triple Play Thursday requests. And also you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. But the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us, follow us now. And subscribe to our podcast. Lots of people listen to our podcast. We appreciate that. Some people obviously can't stay up between 1 and 5 a.m. on the weekday mornings. So they opt for the podcast, which is an easy and awesome and free way to listen to the show. You subscribe. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe. It's free. It'll automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there you go. That's what's happening on this Thursday morning. Let me say hello to Tom Hush, my producer. Tom, how are you?
I'm great, Nick. How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm okay.
Very good.
You excited about you big football fan?
I used to play football when I was in grade school. You know, like yeah. Late elementary school into middle school. I stopped before I got to high school. So during those years, I was a huge football fan. And my dad was a lifelong fan of, believe it or not, the New England Patriots, not the Bears.
Why?
It's because when he first came to the States, one of the first places he went was Boston. It was Boston, like New England area.
Yeah.
He was doing some work there. And there's a huge, you know, Irish and Scottish and, yeah. and British community there.
Yes, there is.
And so he just kind of fell in love with it. And he really, really enjoyed his time in New England. And he became a Pats fan. It was really strange.
Wow.
It was really, really strange. And this is way before Tom Brady.
Yeah.
Back in the day, my first Pats jersey as a kid was Drew Bledsoe.
Sure.
So, I've carried that on. I mean, I'm a Bears fan just kind of by proxy, just by the fact that I grew up here in the Chicagoland area. So I'm really excited for this. One of the great rivalries of football.
The big celebration in Grant Park that starts at noon and goes all the way through till the end of the game, till 11 o'clock. There's going to be all kinds of activities, and there's going to be entertainment, and there's going to be celebrities. And you can stay outside and watch the game, too, if you want to watch it out on the big screen out in Grant Park. And obviously the game will be taking place here at Soldier Field. Kicking off, it's the first NFL game of the season, the 100th NFL season. And there are no other games tonight. So all eyes, it's a national game. It's going to be on NBC. So all eyes will be on Chicago. And it's going to be a big deal for football fans. I'm not the biggest football fan in the world, so I think it's cool, but I don't really care either way about the game. But I think it's cool for the city, and it's going to be a lot of fun for a ton of people, including Vic Vaughn, who's in the newsroom. Hi, Vic.
Took a day off for it.
I know you did. I know you're off Friday morning. And because you're going to be, you took the day off because you want to be up and watch all the activities and during the day and then watch the game, because otherwise you're not going to get any sleep if you do that. You come in here with no sleep, that's not good.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
you got the day off, and you got Friday morning off, and you'll enjoy the game and the festivities because you live right over Grant Park.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. So you could just walk right over to Grant Park and be a part of the crazy free festivities that are going on all day and into the night.
Yeah, I'm going to check it out tomorrow during the day, and then I'll get out of there before the game starts.
Yeah.
Watch it at home.
Big weekend for you and your partner there in both major sports that are happening right now.
Yeah, because she's from Racine, Wisconsin.
She's from Racine, Wisconsin. So you got the big NFL kickoff game. 100 years of the NFL kicked off here in Chicago at Soldier Field with one of the greatest sports rivalries of all time. So she's a Green Bay fan.
Yes.
Also tonight, first pitch at 6:10. Cubs are in Milwaukee, so it's going to be, and then for the rest of the weekend, it's a four-game series throughout the entire weekend.
I am hoping that it goes well for me, that's all, because it's going to be a long weekend, like you said, four-game series.
That's a four-game series.
And the big one between us is the Packers and the Bears, because it's only a couple times a year, right? So this is huge.
And it's also, the rivalry is much longer.
The trash talking is more serious too in our place when it's football.
That's the case with all Bears and Packers fans.
Yeah,
I mean the trash talking is massive. It's huge. It goes on year round. But the thing about Milwaukee is that Milwaukee spent the Milwaukee Brewers spent the majority of their time in the American League. I mean, they were in the American League much longer than they were in the National League. So it didn't really become a rivalry until then.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So they were in the American League for a long period of time. But yeah. Anyway, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I'm just really.
I think our relationship will make it.
I hope so. I hope you can survive a couple of sporting events over the weekend. I really do.
Yeah, it's all in good fun.
Is that the plan? Is it going to be the Chicago versus Wisconsin weekend? Is that what you guys are doing this weekend?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll pretty much circulate around those games.
Yeah,
my kids are here too, and they're all Cubs and Bears fans, so it'll be fun.
Oh, that'll be a good time. And by the way, you are off from the newsroom tomorrow, but you are going to join us at 3:30 for Vic's Picks.
That's right. And for those listeners who remember Jordan Bernfield, he used to be a sports reporter here. He will be in the news anchor chair with you guys. So,
how about that?
Yeah,
Jordan Bernfield.
Love Jordan Bernfield.
I do too.
I won't see him. So tell him I said hi.
I will absolutely tell Jordan you said hi. When I heard that he was filling in, I was like, what? Jordan Bernfield's going to be in the newsroom? Yeah. I haven't seen him in such a long time. He and I have something in common. We're both ridiculous Dave Matthews fans,
and have seen
Dave multiple times live, and have actually run into each other at shows.
Oh, is that right?
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. So it's going to be a fun weekend, and it's all going to kick off tonight at 7:20 is the kickoff for the Bear game against the Packers, kicking off the 100th NFL season, and it's going to be. It's a big deal. It's going to be a big deal, and all you football fans out there, man, I hope you all have fun and be safe and all that cool stuff. So, it's going to be a fun weekend. Okay, let's take a break. And when we come back, it's time for our bi-weekly visit with Dan Feinberg, TV critic from The Hollywood Reporter, and we will talk all things TV.
We're going to have our TV party tonight.
All right!
We're going to have our TV party, all right!
Tonight!
Saturday Night Live!
Monday Night Football! Jefferson!
All right. My
welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your request in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Because It, Chapter 2, is coming out this weekend, we're going to talk about some fascinating facts about your favorite horror movies, and we're going to talk about the scariest books ever written. In honor of that sequel, which is being released this weekend. So that's all coming up. 312-981-7200. But right now, it is that time. Every 2 weeks, we talk with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we talk TV. There's a lot of TV to talk about, and he's with us every couple of weeks. So let's bring Dan on right now. Hey, Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you much, Nick.
How are you?
I'm okay. Just enjoying the end of the late summer rush of TV and bracing myself for the start of the fall rush of TV.
Yes.
Once upon a time, there used to be a downtime, but as we always say, no such thing anymore.
Not anymore. We were talking a little bit about some of the new fall shows that people are interested in, like some of the network things. And the one that still stands out for me, which we can talk about later when you're allowed to talk about it, as I've mentioned before, is Evil on CBS. That's the one that I'm most intrigued by.
I am definitely hoping that I get to see a couple more episodes, or at least one more episode, before I get to talk about that, because I need a better sense of what the show is. It remains intriguing and, you know, it's been so long since there's been a genuinely intriguing network drama that it would be nice if one of several kind of iffy shows on the fall slates actually emerges as something good. I'll believe it when I see it, though.
Okay. Have you seen Mixed-ish?
I have seen Mixed-ish, and it is another one where, like almost everything else this fall, I don't know that it's necessarily a uniformly awful fall. I feel like last fall was uniformly awful, and I could have told you right up front nearly everything was going to be bad, and anything that became okay was almost a shocker. Just about everything this fall could maybe get good, potentially, but I need to see more episodes. So I'm hoping that the network's gotten far enough lead time on the fall shows that maybe we'll get two episodes of a few shows, or three, heaven forbid, because I want to see how a bunch of things evolve.
Okay. Another one that I'm kind of in, because I like Colby Smulders so much, I'm interested in Stumptown. They've been advertising that one pretty heavily, too.
And guess what? That's another one of the ones that's in the it could be good range, but I would love to see a second episode so I can see what the actual show is. It's the challenge of the fall season, is that I'm kind of basing everything off of one episode or two if I'm lucky, as opposed to when I review a show from Netflix or Amazon or whatever, where for the most part I've seen 4, 6, 8 the entire season of episodes. So it puts the networks at a disadvantage that they're already at anyway, because they have all the time restrictions, content restrictions, etc., and they have yet to figure out how to combat the disparity between what cable and streaming services are able to do in terms of outlay of episodes, not just to critics, but just in terms of how many episodes they've actually been able to see and process before they're putting them on the air. Instead, for the most part, the broadcast networks are in a old model where they're putting stuff on air where they've only seen one or two episodes as well. It's an old school model, and I don't want to say it's broken, but it's not working out well in terms of quality, and things could be done better.
Well, what have you heard about Watchmen?
Watchmen, that is one where I've seen one episode, and I can tell you that I'm very intrigued, and I anticipate hopefully seeing more episodes. It is big and meaty and substantive. That is not a review, because I'm definitely embargoed on reviews, but it is not an insignificant thing. So that is a compliment from me. It is a thing that requires processing. The question on the show is going to be whether, A, audiences are prepared to be processing things, and if that's what they want, and if... You know, just if it's going to continue to be that strong. But I have a lot of faith in Damon Lindelof after Leftovers. It's kind of the gap between people who only think of Damon Lindelof in terms of Lost and maybe Prometheus, and they're like, ruined Lost was horrible, blah, blah, blah. He's awful. He's a hack. And the people who watched Leftovers and saw that he guided that series through a 3-season arc that was verging on perfection. So, if you're just in the I only know him from Lost and Prometheus camp, you're probably not giving him any faith, whereas your friendly neighborhood TV critic, who most likely loved Leftovers, is feeling right now like Damon Lindelof has at least some leeway. So it's a difference in audience responses, and I feel like, you know, maybe the casual viewer who might like the show might have trepidation that a TV critic might not. I genuinely looking forward to more episodes of the network stuff. For the most part, it's I would like it because I would like to give the stuff more chance.
Got it.
And to actually do justice to it. But Watchmen, I want to see more.
In a few weeks, we'll be able to talk. You know, with the embargo will be lifted, you'll be able to review some of these.
Looking forward to it. That one is October, so definitely there's time to build up anticipation and appetite, and I certainly am ready to see more.
Okay, and one more that I want to what do you know about Mr. In Between on FX?
Well, did you watch the first season of that one or not?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. That one is the first season is out there, and it's entertaining and quirky, and I think you would probably like it. It is sort of violent and edgy, and it's a very FX-y kind of dark comedy, and the first season was only 6 episodes. They're short episodes. And I personally need to watch the last one or two of them because things just sort of get rolled up. And even if I love things, sometimes I fall behind. But yeah, you should definitely check out the first season of that one because it's very interesting. I don't know that it's going to be for everyone, but I think it has a solid sensibility and some interesting performances and tonal things that people don't necessarily know. And it's a very much under the radar show, I feel like, because I didn't even
know about it. Seriously, I didn't even know about it. And I watch FX all the time. I know that they've been advertising, you know, the premiere like crazy on FX now, but I just don't remember it being in my wheelhouse at all.
They ran through it very quickly. It was only, I think, a 6-episode first season. They acquired it out of Sundance. It was produced for FX in Australia, which is not directly tied to FX in the States, but FX in the States picked it up. And I think that they may have, my memory could be wrong on this, have doubled up episodes, so it might have only aired in a 3-week period.
Oh, I see.
But even if it did air over 6 weeks, and I really think it might have been doubled up, because it's a half-hour show, I think it just went by so quickly that if you didn't process it, and it wasn't, you know, it was well-received, but it wasn't buzzy in the same way that a lot of FX shows are, and it has a lot to do with the fact that the cast is relative unknowns to people in the States. But yeah, only 6 episodes. You can burn through that one in a hurry and either get excited for season 2 or move on because there's a lot of TV.
All right. By the way, you were right about Lodge 49. I should have been watching that show from the beginning. That, I got to say, I don't know how the hell you can write about it. I don't know how anybody can talk about. I don't know how anybody can talk about it. It's one of the craziest shows I've ever seen, but it is so good and so strange and so original. I love it. I think it's great. And my friend David Pasquazi is fantastic on it. It's like some of the best work he's ever done.
The entire cast is terrific. It is a remarkable cast. My review praised the casting directors to the sky because every part is well selected, and so many of the people in it are you know, just working character actors and you know, people who do, you know, Chicago theater, New York theater, who are that kind of actor who under normal circumstances would pop up in an episode or two of things and you'd go, okay, that was a colorful, good performance there. And here they're regulars. You know, Brent Jennings, who's pretty much the second lead in the show, is is this guy who's just done one-off guest spots his entire career, and suddenly somebody said, here, you're now number two on a call sheet. Have fun. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
Sonia Cassidy, who's the female lead, is a British actress. I am really good with the accent game. I get annoyed so fast with British and Aussie actors coming stateside and doing kind of flat American accents and not being good. I was shocked because I hadn't seen her in Humans, which was on AMC, and some people like, I just hadn't seen it. And she's remarkable. It is such a good cast, and it is such an indescribable show.
It
and
is.
When you tell people, you've just got to catch the vibe and go with it.
Right.
It throws people off, I think.
I agree. I can't. I mean, I don't even know what to say about it. It is so just, I've never seen anything like it. And I love Wyatt Russell, and every time I see him from Overlord or anything else that he's been in, there are moments when he looks and sounds exactly like his dad. And you know, sometimes he doesn't, but then there are moments where you go, oh my God, he looks exactly like Kurt Russell. And he's really great in the show, like really great.
It's another show that we like that not everyone is going to like, but it is definitely a show that more people would like than are currently watching it. So I'm just trying to get people to watch it because it's not going to last forever if people don't check it out, and a lot of people would like it. Some people wouldn't, and if it's not your vibe, it's not your vibe. But I figured it would be your vibe, and I think a lot of people.
No, you were absolutely right. I love it. I think it's great. It's on AMC. It's Lodge 49, and it's we can't describe it, but trust us, it's really original, really really great, and filled with amazing performances. So thank you for that and insisting on that I watch it, Dan, because you were right on the money with that.
Glad you actually dug in and enjoyed it.
Okay, all right, Dan, hang on a second. All right.
Sure.
Okay, Dan Feinberg is with us. He joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV. We're going to break for the news, and then after the news, we'll jump right back in. Lots of TV to talk about right here on 720 WGN.
Stop shopping, even. Stop buying things.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. It is Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. As I'm sure everybody on the planet knows, unless you've been living in a cabin somewhere, Chapter 2 opens this weekend. It's the much anticipated sequel to the movie and continuation based on the Stephen King novel. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And then I've got some great and fun, fascinating facts about your favorite horror movies. And we're going to talk about some of the scariest books ever written. That's all in honor of the release of It Chapter 2. But right now, we are talking with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Let's get back to talking TV with Dan. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
Okay, a couple of HBO things I wanted to talk about. How do you feel about them moving The Deuce to Monday?
I think that, it sort of goes multiple ways. The first way to look at it is, it's the last season, and they don't need to worry about having it in the quote-unquote Sunday spot, whatever it is. And currently they have Succession there, and Succession is phenomenal.
Yes.
And
yes.
So it's just there, and I assume we're going to talk about Succession after we talk about
this.
Yes, we are. I'm not jumping ahead. It's not like it needs to be in the prestige Sunday spot, and also, thanks to Chernobyl and Gentleman Jack to some degree, the Monday slot has, in the past few months, become a really reputable place for HBO to be programming. It was never like a dumping ground, but it was the place where HBO programmed their documentaries, and it was a great slot for that. They've decided to expand into more different scripted potential slots, including the Friday night slot that they've been using in the 11 p.m. hour for Los Espookies and for Black Lady Sketch Show. So, you know, they're going into these different areas as opposed to it just every single week being, okay, the prestige slot is Sunday nights from 9 to you know, 11, that's what it is. And so to me, it's perfectly fine. And it's saying, once again, we put legitimate shows in this place, shows that we respect, shows we like. I have now caught up on through the second season of The Deuce, so I am ready to start on the third season. I have not watched any screeners yet, but I am now caught up through season two and looking forward to season three, hoping it ends well, because for the most part, David Simon ends his shows well, even if you don't think that season five of The Wire was the best season of The Wire, which it's not. It still ended reasonably well. Terme ended reasonably well, etc. Yeah. So
I don't think season five is the best season of The Wire. I'm in the minority because I think season two is the best season of The Wire. Way in the minority on that. Everybody thinks that's the weakest season, the season that takes place on the docks. That's my favorite season.
It is. Anyone who thinks it's the weakest season is just wrong. They're just not paying attention. They're frustrated because it doesn't have all the characters who they loved in the first season and the third season. And to me, that's not an illegitimate problem, because you can be like, okay, I miss those characters.
Yeah.
But it is wrong to say that the second season is bad or lesser. To me, the second season is significantly better than the fifth season, and I think the second season is a fantastic season of TV. I personally prefer the third season, but that's just a preference.
Well, you know, at this point, it's like that is beyond using the word nitpicking when it comes to The Wire, because every season is brilliant. Every episode is great. It's the best TV show that's ever been on TV, and I thought he wrapped it up beautifully in season five, even if the entire season wasn't as great as some other seasons. But I thought that final episode with everything being wrapped up was amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
To me, it's a little too neat. A little too neat in an entire series that was all about how neatness is impossible in a city like Baltimore. And the ending to me is just a bit too clean and too final. Mm-hmm. And David Simon saying, okay, I know I have to end it. I would have loved it to have been a little bit messier in the way that the entire series was up until that point. It's still a great season of TV.
Yeah.
To me, it's just, of the five, the least. Whatever.
I remember the episode where, you know, because my ex-wife and I used to watch The Wire, you know, obviously religiously. And so her favorite character, like most people's favorite character on The Wire, is Omar. And so HBO was doing this thing back then where they were showing the following week's episode before they would air it, and it was available on demand. So I would watch them sometimes, you know, like, because of my schedule, I get home and my ex-wife would be asleep. And so I would watch the episode sometimes ahead of time. Which, of course, she wasn't thrilled about, because it's one of those things where, you know, where couples need to watch stuff together. I don't understand that, but that's a thing. But anyway, so I the episode where they kill off Omar, I watched before her. She was asleep. And, of course, I was completely shocked when Omar got killed, and how they handled it was just so brilliant. She loved Omar. So the next night, or the next day, she gets up, and I was going to go out with her brother, in fact, and we were like, okay, let's sit and watch, because I just wanted to see her reaction. So I said, before we go out, we were going to go and have some drinks at the bar. I said, let's watch a little bit of The Wire here. And so she's watching it, and I'm watching her, and it gets to the point like 20 minutes into the episode when they kill off Omar, and I could not believe her reaction. It was like, like her face like completely went, it drained. And then she looked at me, because she knew I had watched the episode, and she said, why didn't you tell me? And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm going to tell you that they killed off Omar in the episode? Are you kidding me? But it was like one of the most insane things I've ever like witnessed, because I'd already seen it. So when the scene was coming up, when he walked into the convenience store, I just started watching her, and it was pretty amazing to watch. That's how connected people were, at least some of us were, to that show.
It's a great season of TV, the fifth season, and it's a great series, and the second season of The Wire is fantastic, and anyone who tries to tell you otherwise, just move on and don't trust their opinion on that particular thing.
Right.
I'm sure they have fine opinions on other things, but on that particular issue, they are incorrect.
Yeah. All right, let's get to Succession now. If the episode before last, if people were ever wondering if the definite question of whether the show is a comedy or not, that question was answered the week before last in what I thought was an absolutely hilarious episode. And anybody who doubts that there's a comedic element to the show, a huge comedic element to the show, is crazy if they watched that episode and didn't think so.
Anybody who doubts that there's a comedic element, for sure.
Yeah.
There are a couple people I follow on Twitter who had incorrect opinions, who are like, is it intentionally trying to be funny? Of course it is.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, this past week's episode, and we don't want to give anything away, is simultaneously laugh out loud hilarious,
yes,
and soul crushingly sad. It's both.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Now, you interviewed Jeremy Strong. How'd that go?
Terrifically. He's one of those theater trained actors, darn it. And so, you know, I think he might be Yale drama, but we talked for 25 minutes. He's dropping references to Chekhov and Dostoevsky and the Manchurian Candidate and The Revenant, and he's just, you know, referencing things left and right, and he is smart, and because his character is in the middle of an arc that is just sheer misery at this point,
yeah,
again, don't want to spoil anything, but
yep,
people who aren't watching Succession really should be,
yep,
he told me when I asked him, when I explained to him that I viewed the show as a dark comedy with veins of tragedy, he's like, yeah, no, I view it as a tragedy with veins of comedy. That's, you know, and from his perspective and his character's perspective, that's exactly very clearly what it is. On the other hand, if you don't think that the show has comedic elements after watching Alan Ruck's eulogy in this episode, that's all I will say on that. That is one of the great pieces of comic writing and,
yeah,
comic performance you could watch on television.
I agree. I totally agree.
It is both of those things. I still think primarily it is a dark comedy because I laughed at more of the episode than made me sad, but it definitely does both of those,
yeah,
things.
And I'm thinking to myself, well, how can we make this show better? Is it possible to make this show better? Holly Hunter. I mean, my God. I mean, let's add to this cast. Let's just put Holly Hunter in. I mean, this is amazing.
They are doing an amazing job of just introducing people, and they don't necessarily need to stay over long. So I don't know how much. I haven't gotten to this week's episode yet.
Yeah.
So I don't know if she's coming back and how prominently, in the same way that, you know, Danny Houston has been popping up occasionally. And it's just like, whatever, okay, sure, Danny Houston's a part of this universe. He doesn't need to be a central part. He just,
yeah,
pops up when he pops up. And Danny Houston is an actor who, when he is ill-used, can be genuinely horrible. I think he sometimes can misgauge the tone of a piece entirely. Within this context, he's brilliant and perfect and couldn't be better used.
Yeah.
But the whole cast is so good, and it is such a good show. And having Lodge 49, there are just some really great things on at the moment. And but Succession is on a tear, and Jeremy Strong was a incredibly smart and thoughtful interview, and folks can check it out on the Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah, it is. It's Hollywood Reporter. Check out the fine print. We have a link on our Facebook page to take you directly to that. Okay, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. Lots more TV to talk about. He joins us every other week, TV critic for the Hollywood Reporter, and check him out at Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN. We have a link on our Facebook page, too, at facebook.com/NickDShow. More after this on 720 WGN. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio and right here until 5 a.m. Triple Play Thursday. Get your request in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. And let's get back to our conversation. Dan Feinberg joins us biweekly to talk TV, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right, so tell us about Wu-Tang and American Saga. This is on Hulu, and I've been seeing a lot of press about it, and I'm really curious about it. What did you think?
It has definitely been a year of
yeah,
Wu-Tang Clan origin stories,
yeah,
and nothing wrong with that, because I'm always happy to spend more quality time with the Woo, and to have more excuses to listen to Enter 36 Chambers, etc. This one, in contrast to Showtime's Of Mice and Men, is actually a scripted drama series with actors, but the RZA, who was an executive producer but maybe hands-off on the Showtime documentary, was actually a co-creator here with Alex Tsai, and he wrote the first couple episodes, or co-wrote, rather, and is an executive producer, as are many of the surviving members of the Wu-Tang Clan and also Old Dirty Bastard's estate. And basically, it picks up in the early 90s in New York City and Staten Island, and it traces the very, very beginnings of the individuals who would come together to form the Wu-Tang Clan. And it is very much an ongoing scripted series. It is not a mini series or a limited series, I don't believe. I've seen 8 of the 10 episodes of the first season, and it only barely is, you know, the tip of the iceberg in terms of introducing these characters, in terms of, you know, introducing their talents and showing sort of how they got propelled to stardom. So I think, you know, at the pace at which they're going, I'm really looking forward to season 2 or season 3 of it. I kind of wish there had been a little bit more energy and flair to the first season. It's kind of tiptoeing around a lot of innovative things that kind of capture the influences of the Wu-Tang Clan, whether it's martial arts movies or comic books or just sort of general pop culture of the moment. It tiptoes around using those stylistic flourishes and the grammar of those genres in its storytelling. To me, it didn't do quite enough, and I would have liked more commitment to being innovative in depicting a group that has been so innovative.
Okay, it's an interesting cast, though. You know, to play these guys. Now, how much did the remaining members of Wu-Tang have over the casting? Did they have any power over who played who?
I don't think so. I think probably RZA had the most control, because he was sort of the active executive producer,
right,
and also the, you know, the creator of the show, whereas most of the others were probably there just kind of monitoring the way in which they were being generally depicted. But the thing is, because, you know, self-mythologizing has been so central to the group entirely, it's not like there's all that much that you could say about any of these guys and the things they were doing before they broke with Wu-Tang Clan that would become scandalous. You know, if you've seen Of Mice and Men, they're perfectly happy to just sit there and talk about, yeah, we were dealing drugs, we were, you know, people were getting shot all around us, et cetera, et cetera. That was just the life we were living before this happened. And so, you know, it's definitely not a very whitewashed version of their story. It definitely is a, you know, here they are, they're selling crack in 2 different corners of Staten Island, and that was kind of where things started. So, yeah, that's where it starts and where it goes.
Okay. All right. So that's Wu-Tang Clan and American Saga, which is now on Hulu. Are they doing what Hulu normally does and just releasing a couple and then doing it weekly?
Yes, I believe that the first 3 episodes were dropped yesterday and
okay,
will then be weekly. And it's very good. A lot of the young actors are varying degrees of recognizable, and it's interesting to watch some of them play. And some of the actors are rappers in their own right. So, you know, people who are fans of New York City hip hop might know Dave East, who was featured in the Netflix hip-hop documentary series, and he's playing Method Man. No one's actually calling him Method Man at this point. You have to sort of be aware of, to some degree, where these people are going. I think it is a series that requires a certain amount of foreknowledge, so I almost think people should watch at least the first couple installments of Mice and Men, which I loved, and that way it gives you a primer on what's coming to some degree, because it really does help if you know who each of these individual actors are and who the characters are and where they're eventually going to be. I think that helps the storytelling a lot.
Okay, great. I'm looking forward to it. Wu-Tang and American Saga on Hulu, which three episodes are already up, and then every Wednesday they'll drop another one for streaming. Okay, you wrote a critic's notebook piece, and even though the show has ended, we have to talk about Baskets. Even though it's not on anymore, you wrote a piece called "The End of Baskets and the Struggle of Loving Niche TV." I love that idea. We talk about stuff that not a lot of people. We just talked about Lodge 49 not too long ago. Baskets was the final episode of Baskets. I mean, the season was spectacular, and the final episode was, I thought, beautiful. I thought it was absolutely beautiful. It actually made me cry. I thought it was just great. So where did you, and by the way, we talked about, you know, the last time you were on a couple of weeks ago before the final episode ever aired, I told you that, you know, those I love the synopses that they do for it. And it was Martha gets her cast off. The way they handled that on the show was spectacular. The way it was handled, everything on that episode was great. All right, I'm assuming you felt satisfied with the way Baskets ended.
Oh, I felt utterly satisfied. I don't think it was my favorite episode of the season. I think probably I preferred the three or four episodes leading up to it. But I think that the finale, I think Jonathan Crystal and company knew, whether they knew 100% or only 95% or 90%, that they weren't going to be getting a season five. I think they knew well enough that they knew that they had to be resolving things. And unlike The Wire, which we talked about earlier, I felt like it was a very organic piece of attempting to resolve things. And it didn't feel like it violated or cheapened any of the themes of the show. It simply put the characters on a somewhat more resolved path without necessarily giving quote-unquote closure, because it's not like the show had any big, you know, lingering questions or anything. And I found it really satisfying, and I was glad that they got to resolve it as much as they did and that they got to take it where they wanted it to go. And I'll miss the show. And the point of the column I wrote was that, you know, it's, you'd think that this 500 scripted show universe with a zillion channels and streaming services, and I mean, next week Walmart is releasing a streaming show, for heaven's sakes.
Oh my god.
Vudu, which will be a Walmart streaming affiliated channel in some way, is releasing a TV version of Mr. Mom that I haven't seen a single second of other than a trailer. It's such a weird world for television, and yet these little shows that are niche shows, they're not necessarily living forever. It's not like people are saying, okay, well, you can just go and tell your story. So if you're a fan of Patriot, you didn't get resolution on that show. If you were a fan of the OA, you didn't get resolution on that show. If you're a fan of a bunch of these really small shows, you're going to feel as if you aren't getting resolution. So it's important to champion the things that you love. It's important to go out there and say, you know, I love this thing, and even if it's only the 270 of you who are going to love it also, you know, talk about the things you love and see if you can get it to 280 or 290. See if Lodge 49 can find another dozen viewers thanks to us talking about it.
Yeah.
And it's just tough because you want to nurture the special little weird shows. And Baskets was a weird show. Lodge 49 is a weird show. But isn't it satisfying when you find the group of people who love the weird things that you love?
Yeah, it is. It's great. And it ended beautifully. And like I said, it made me tear up when Chip referred to Ken as dad. I pretty much lost it at that. I pretty much lost it at that point. Just such subtle stuff like that. It was a great show, and I was happy that it ran for the seasons that it did run. And I'm sad to see it go, but man, it was great. It really was great.
And it's a reassuring thing to be able to tell viewers for future purposes, four seasons, but it's four seasons, and you aren't going to get to the end feeling as if you were left you know, dangling and that you didn't get what you wanted. If you check in on baskets now, yes, it's over, but you can just settle in and watch it. It's four seasons, and you'll like where it goes if you like what the weird thing it does.
Yeah, okay. I agree with everything you said there, Dan. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us, Hollywood reporter, TV critic. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We'll come back and talk more with Dan about TV right after this. Welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And this weekend, It Chapter 2 opens up, a much-anticipated sequel to the unbelievably successful It from a couple of years ago, and the continuation of the very long and very popular Stephen King novel. So in honor of a big horror movie opening this weekend, we're going to talk about some of the most fascinating facts about our favorite horror movies, and we'll talk about some of the scariest books ever written. So that's all coming up. We want to hear from you. We'd love for you to contribute, and you can at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Before we get to that, talk a little bit more here with Dan Feinberg, who joins us every other week, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can check him out on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. So, all right. The Dark Crystal. Now, I'm a little old to have been fascinated by that film. I was 18 when it came out, and I was never really, you know, I thought it was okay. I thought it was fine. But I know people who absolutely love it, and it was an essential part of their childhood. And a lot of people feel the same way about Labyrinth as well. I like Labyrinth more than The Dark Crystal. Dark Crystal is now on Netflix, and it's The Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance. Tell us about this.
It is a prequel to the movie that was directed by Jim Henson and Frank Oz way back in the day. I was a little bit younger, and it was more a part of my demographic conversation, but I don't think I ever thought it was a great movie. And rewatching it ahead of Age of Resistance, I still don't think it's a great movie. I think that it is visually marvelously innovative. I think that the puppeteering is generally tremendous and as good as it got at that moment. I think the entire movie suffers because the main characters, the Gelfling heroes, are beyond boring. They're just dismal characters, and they're the weakest puppets in the movie.
Yeah.
The series, which is 10 episodes, is a massive leap forward or advancement in the overall technology, but it doesn't like replace it. And I think it's important to acknowledge the puppeteering in the movie is for the most part remarkable, and so nothing should be taken away from that. But the new version is heavily puppeteering it, but it's also little bits of CG. Sometimes it feels a tiny bit too much. You know, they're sort of smoothing over things and erasing the poles and the wires when they exist, or the puppeteers when they would have been visible otherwise. It is, in terms of storytelling and character, it is such a massive step forward from the movie. They're almost incomparable. It's actually just a good piece of storytelling, and the characters are wonderfully likable and endearing. The vocal cast is ridiculous. It is such an amazing vocal cast that, like, Alicia Vikander, who, you know, did win an Oscar just a few years ago, she pops up in an episode. It's just like, okay, whatever, fine. She's a Muppet.
Yeah, that list of the voice cast is insane. I mean, it's crazy.
And it's a lot of fun, and sometimes you recognize their voices, like Jason Isaacs is the voice of the main Skeksis, the villainous creature, and you recognize his voice because he sounds like himself, and Eddie Izzard has a small part which sounds like him, and then there's the assortment of people who are doing the kind of Jim Henson, Frank Oz, Muppet voice, so it sounds a little bit Grovery or Yoda-y, and so those people include, like, Simon Pegg is doing one of those voices. Andy Samberg pops up in a very broadly comedic role. But the vocal cast is amazing. You actually feel some emotions, and not just the general awe of being impressed with the production. The entire thing was directed by Louis Leterrier, who
I run hot and cold on that guy.
Totally. He's done some interesting genre stuff. I think if you watched his early movies, you watched The Transporter and a couple of his earlier things, you would have gone, okay, here's a kind of guy who does good, solid B movies, and that's good. You know, like, good on him for that. But then you watch a couple of his later things. You watch something like the bloated Clash of the Titans remake, and you'd be like, oh, yeah, total hack.
Yeah.
Like, where did the good stuff go? And the Incredible Hulk is sort of in between. I think it is not a bad movie, but it's not all that interesting. But here, he directed all 10 episodes, and it is a genuine achievement. It really is. It never feels stagey or wooden. There are action beats. There are emotional beats that hit home. I think if you watch the movie, you would discover that the action is, that there's a limit to what they can do. It's a very clear limit, and you can see where they just simply couldn't do things and where emotional beats fell short because the Gelflings couldn't emote sufficiently. It's all gone. I'm not going to tell anyone that this needed to be 10 hours, the series. It's long, and it does feel a little excessive at a lot of points, but you understand why they made it. You understand why this was a continued story they wanted to tell, and it's really impressive. I think this is... It's satisfying in a way that played to grown-up me without pandering to my nostalgia, because my nostalgia is mixed already. It was just entertaining for me.
Okay. So, wow. Yeah. Okay. That's impressive. That's a great review. I'm kind of surprised at that. But
no, I think if you watch, your initial reaction will be, I'm not sure I'm getting into. I'm not sure if I really care about the world or any of this, but it's really pretty. And then at a certain point, you just start to care.
Wow. Okay. Very cool. All right. That's on Netflix. And is that streaming already?
Yep. It is streaming already. All available in totality. It is probably, I would say it is too dark for the smallest of children, but I would also say that for people of my generation, a lot of people I know were scarred by how dark and freaky certain parts of the movie were as well. I would not recommend it for the smallest of children, but I think it probably plays well to, people 10 and up. I'm making up a number there.
Okay.
I use some discretion. It's a little scary and disturbing in places, but it's also really good.
Okay, cool. All right, some announcements from Saturday Night Live have happened. It comes back September 28th. Leslie Jones has left, which I was surprised by. I didn't think she was gonna leave. I'm not a fan of Leslie Jones, quite frankly, but I was surprised by her departure. What did you think of that move?
Well, we don't know the exact logistics of what the thought process was. I think basically what we're saying is that she wanted to do other things, and she's an utterly unique situation because she was significantly older when she started getting her on-screen appearances.
Yep.
And when she became a regular, she is kind of without precedent in terms of becoming a cast regular and a star at the point at which she did. So it is totally fair to my mind for her to say, whatever the rest of my career is, I want to see what my opportunities are. So totally cool with that. I'm not going to miss her in the sketches. She was a hit and miss sketch performer. I think she did get better, but you know, she always seemed to have problems reading the cue cards, but then again, so did Robert De Niro, and he got nominated for an Emmy, so, you know, let's not pretend that Leslie Jones is in some way unique. You know, for heaven's sakes, Christopher Walken is an SNL hosting legend for being able to badly read cue cards.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, one of the reasons why the cowbell sketch has gone on in history is because Christopher Walken is just looking, he has no connection with anything that's happening on stage. And that's one of the reasons why it's been revered so much. Like, Christopher Walken is totally into the teleprompter or the cue cards. Meanwhile, he doesn't even know that anybody's breaking on stage or what's happening. So that's one of the reasons go ahead.
Yeah, and so I don't think Leslie Jones had, like, moments like that, obviously. But I think, on the other hand, if you watched the way that she interacted with Colin Jost and made him break, and the way that she basically humanized him in a way that I'm not sure anyone else is really capable of doing. A couple of the other interacting people do similar things, but I will miss her on Weekend Update. I think that what she did was unique and different there, and her voice will be missed. I will miss her, I would say, in the balance. And I think she's extremely funny in some ways and maybe not so funny in other ways, but I think that all she has to do is keep plugging away, and I think she'll find some of the things that she does very well. And if nothing else, you know, her Twitter videos during the Olympics and Game of Thrones and all of that, I think she is tremendous at reacting to things, and I look forward to seeing what she does next.
They've announced five of the hosts. The season premiere is going to be Woody Harrelson, which I liked. I mean, he hasn't hosted it in 5 years, but I think Woody Harrelson will be very funny. He was funny the last time he hosted. And man, I'm so excited. I bet you're excited too. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is hosting. That's going to be great.
I think the Phoebe Waller-Bridge Taylor Swift episode ought to be a classic. I hope that they give her as much wiggle room and leeway to actually give input as she is physically capable of doing. She's a busy person. I don't expect she's going to sit in the writer's room, you know, for 10 days leading up. But as much as they want to let her steer what her experience is, the show would benefit from that. But yes, I am very much looking forward to that episode.
October 12th, David Harbour from Stranger Things. I'm interested to see that. I think he'll do a good job.
I think it'll be fine. I'm not, like, excited about it in the same way that I am about Phoebe Waller-Bridge or a couple of the later people.
And then November 2nd, Kristen Stewart. I loved the episode that she hosted, and she dropped the F-bomb during her monologue, if I remember correctly. And I'm looking forward to that.
She's good.
Yeah.
She is a good SNL host, and I think that was why they announced her early, and then the other person.
Well, the other one, of course, is Eddie Murphy, who is coming back in, what, 34, since 1984 is the last time he hosted, was in 1984. So the ratings are going to be through the roof for that one, no question.
I think there will be definite curiosity, and I am just taking a wait-and-see attitude.
Me too.
Because there was all of the hype about, you know, him coming back for the 30th anniversary, and that did not materialize as anything actually good.
Yeah.
And my concern would be, you know, it's one thing for bygones to be bygones and for him to be willing to come back and all that, but okay, so that's good. Okay, what you're going to do?
Yeah.
And I'm curious. But, you know, these return nostalgia appearances are often very good. Adam Sandler was
surprisingly good. Yeah, surprisingly good. Well,
if they find a way to balance, again, a little bit like Dark Crystal, nostalgia and actually Eddie Murphy, you know, being as funny as he is or he isn't. I think that is what it will come down to. But I'm very curious about that. Looking forward to Kristen Stewart and very excited about Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Yeah, I agree with you on all of those assessments. I'm looking forward to it. Well, listen, you know, the next time we talk will be post-Emmys.
Slightly pre-Emmys, I believe.
Oh, is it pre-Emmys? Oh, the 23rd is the Emmys. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I was getting confused. I got confused because when I looked it up online, they gave me the Creative Arts Emmys date. And I went, oh, okay.
So we will be able to maybe talk about that.
Yeah, we can. We can. We can.
Those have guest actors and a few technical things. And
right.
So that'll be cool. And then we'll definitely be able to preview the Emmys, and that should be fun. I think the Emmys should be interesting and maybe unpredictable this year, or else maybe it'll just be deep in Game of Thrones and whatever.
All right. Well, yeah, Dan, always a pleasure, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Talk to you soon, Nick.
Okay, take care. Dan Feinberg, everybody, from The Hollywood Reporter. He talks to us every 2 weeks about TV. And the next time, we will preview the Emmys and talk more about the new fall season, because he'll be able to preview a lot of that, too. Okay, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. You know, it's always funny, Tom?
What?
Is that we have four monitors in the studio. I have one is on my is on the console to my left, and I always have that one on channel 9. One is, and three of them are on a shelf that is above the window across the room from me where I see you. One I have on the security camera so that I can see who's in the newsroom, the traffic, sports. The second one is on channel 9. And then the third one is on channel 26, or the U. And I always like it when, you know, at this time of night, when the U and channel 9 both show the same infomercial, but it's off by about 10 seconds. And that's what's happening right now. It's actually about 2 seconds off. And it's for superfood, juicing superfood.
Oh.
It's for like a powdered thing called superfood. Instead of like actually taking vegetables, this is more concentrated stuff. And
concentrated vegetable dust.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You just add it to a glass of water and you stir it, and they do a full half an hour.
Well, they got to tell you everything about it, you know.
Yeah.
They really got to convince you.
The other one that they do a lot in the middle of the night here is the beets one, which is also beet powder. Because beets are really good for you. Beet juice is
very
really,
good,
really
yeah,
good for
very
you.
Very good for you.
And a lot of people hate beets, which I don't understand, because I love beets. I love them.
Just straight up?
Straight up.
Not even like a little bit of I put a little bit of sugar on it?
No, nope, straight up.
Oh, wow.
I love beets. Ever since I was a kid, the jarred, old school jarred pickled beets that come in the red juice. Eat those. I could eat those by the dozen.
Have you ever tried beet juice?
Yes.
Because I know Jules always has.
The Jules has the beet juice. But this thing is, this powdered beet thing, first of all, like if you have a glass of it, it has like the vitamins and minerals of like five whole beets.
That's a lot of beets.
Yeah. So that, like, you want to get your beet fix, this is the stuff. But here's the thing. They went out of their way to let everybody know that it doesn't taste like beets. You know, they that's a big part of the infomercial. You know how they repeat like 50 things over and over again on an infomercial?
Yeah.
That's repeated like 900 times just to make sure that you know it doesn't taste like beets.
Now,
that to me is not a selling point.
No. Well, you're not the consumer they're looking for. You love the beets.
I love beets, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and so does Esmeralda, because we've talked about this. Esmeralda Leon.
She's big into beets.
She's big into beets, too. She loves them. And the only problem with beets is when you prepare them, your kitchen looks like you murdered a family. You like your cutting board, your hands.
It's just covered in red.
Yeah. It's.
Oh, man.
That's why most people, when they prepare beets, they put the rubber gloves on. Yeah.
Yeah. Do they tell you what it's supposed to taste like?
It's supposed to taste like a lovely fruit drink.
So instead, you're drinking beets, but it tastes like high C.
All of the nutritional value that beets have, and they pack a lot of nutritional value. But you hate the taste, and a lot of people hate beets. Whenever I tell people I like beets, they're like, "What?" And even when I tell, especially when I tell them, because again, I grew up in the '70s when a lot of stuff was in cans, you know, and we would do the jarred beets. They were the jarred pickled beets. That's my mom would prepare those. I'd eat them like candy.
Well, you're also a liver person, right?
I am. Liver and onions, could eat that all day. Yeah, I've said this a million times. My parents had no problem feeding me. I know a lot of parents like have issues feeding their kids. You know, no problem. Where's the broccoli? I'll eat it. Like I said, spinach, even the canned stuff that plops out, I still have a soft spot in my heart for that stuff. I love that.
Good job, Mr. and Mrs. DeDillo.
Yeah, I don't know if they had anything to do with it. Maybe it's maybe the genes from, you know, my mom grew up on a farm, so I don't know if there's anything inherent about that.
Yeah.
My mom grew up on a farm in Southern Illinois, and she still says Warsh.
Yeah.
Instead of Wash, she says Warsh. President lives in Washington, D.C.
Oh, my God.
No, that's what she says.
I believe it. No, I believe it. My girlfriend's family in Iowa does the same thing. They say Warsh.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where, I don't know how to pinpoint, you know, what regions that comes from. But Vic's mom.
Also a Warsh.
Also a Warsh.
See, and then they make fun of me because I say Wash.
Oh, yeah, like, as in not Wash, you say Wash?
It's a little bit emphasis. Yeah,
how do you say Chicago?
Chicago.
You don't say Chicago?
Chicago? No, it's like Chicago.
It's Chicago.
It's, yeah.
That's the correct way to say the name of the city. But a lot of people say Chicago.
Chicago. As long as they're not saying Chi-Town.
Yeah, nobody says that
nobody
in this city.
Chi-Town.
Nobody says that in this city. I don't, you know what I mean? You know, like people come in, hey, man, how do you like Chi-Town? It's not Chi-Town. We don't call it Chi-Town. I don't know who made that up. I don't know who's responsible for making up Chi-Town, but nobody who lives in this city ever refers to this city as Chi-Town, and people who live in this city don't go to Navy Pier.
No.
Unless people are in town, unless you're entertaining people and they want to go to Navy Pier. Or unless you're going to IMAX.
That's true. Or when I used to intern over at BEZ, I would go there.
Oh, yeah.
Three times a week I had to go to Navy Pier.
Yeah.
Not a lot of fun.
Yeah. But we don't, like, voluntarily, hey, man, what do you want to do tonight? Let's go to Navy Pier.
All right.
Nobody who lives in Chicago or is from Chicago ever says that.
I imagine in New York they don't call it the Big Apple. No one actually calls it that.
They don't call it the Big Apple. And I don't think a lot of people voluntarily go to the restaurants in Times Square. I don't think a lot. all right. Well, listen, here's the deal. It Chapter 2 comes out this weekend. Who's excited? Is anybody excited? I'm excited. The reviews haven't been very good.
I'm in it for Bill Hader.
But I'm excited because I really like the first one. I thought the first one was really cool and really scary. I'm a big fan of the book, and Bill Hader and James McAvoy and Jessica Chastain are in it. Those are three of my favorite people in movies. Yeah, so it's not been getting great reviews, but Hader's been getting great reviews.
He's been the one thing that people have universally said, this guy is great.
But let's talk about scary stuff. And if you're looking forward to It, Chapter 2, what'd you think of the first one? And then I've got some fascinating facts about our favorite horror movies. This is a lot of fun. And we're going to do that right after we break for the news, which is after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. It's Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday! By the way, I didn't ask who requested the NXS.
It's coming to us from our good pal Ike.
Of course, 80s.
Love it.
All right, so welcome back, everybody, and we're here live in the studio. Now, Channel 9 has moved on to the Cooking with Emeril air oven. And Channel 26 is showing, what are these idiots called? These guys, Impractical Jokers, that's it. That's what you have to choose from on your morning TV. Emeril air cooking and cutting out the grease, or these idiots on the Practical Joker show, or Impractical Joker. All right. Okay, welcome back. So 804, we were talking about Beats before the because that was the last, that was one of the, well, no, they weren't showing that infomercial. They were showing the food, the superfood thing. Cold beet borscht with boiled potatoes, best summer meal ever. Yeah, it's good.
I've never had borscht.
It's really good. It's really good. So all right, so It Chapter 2 comes out this week. Well, it basically opens tonight. And it's expected to be a pretty massive hit over the weekend because the first movie, the first It, made a ton of money.
Broke records.
Yeah.
It saved our theater from a really bad summer.
Yeah. I mean, did it come out in September?
It came out very late August.
Okay.
It was very tail end of the summer, 2017.
Right.
And, you know, we had there were some Marvel tent poles, but it was a little bit like this summer where there was really nothing just catching.
Right.
And then when It came out, we crossed our fingers and we just said, let's go all in on this. And it paid off. People came out and drove.
No, it was, you know, and this thing's going to be, it's going to be packed.
Yeah.
I know. I got the tickets a while ago for the show on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks ago, I ordered them because I figured it was going to be, you know, nuts. And it is. It's going to be nuts. The things, because the reviews have not been all that great, which I don't, you know, I make up my own mind on it. I'm a little concerned about the length.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
It's close to 3 hours.
Yeah.
And I realize it's a big book. And I realize that the original was a miniseries. So it was on, you know, it was a few hours long as a miniseries on TV. But, you know, the first part of the first It part was a little over 2 hours, 10 minutes.
And it never felt like it was dragging long or anything.
Oh, no. The first movie's good. The first movie's really good.
Moved at a pretty good clip.
And it's scary. It's a scary movie. And it's the same director, which I'm looking forward to. I just think it's a little bit long. And I think maybe it went long because they were like, hey, the first movie, everybody loved the first movie. And it was such a big hit. Let's do whatever we want with this one. But I'm looking forward to it. I am. And I love horror movies. And I thought the first It was really good. And I loved Mama. I think this guy is a really good director.
Anthony Muschietti?
Yeah. 301 area code says, I'm looking forward to seeing It Chapter 2 because I really enjoyed the first part. 708 area code says, I still prefer the TV version of It. Tim Curry is the true Pennywise. All right, you can't argue Tim Curry. Because Tim Curry rules the planet. And he was great as Pennywise. But I got to tell, which Skarsgård?
This is Bill Skarsgård.
It's Bill Skarsgård. I was going to say, which Skarsgård is he? I think he's really scary as Pennywise. I think Pennywise in the It movie and the It movies is really scary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really creepy. The voice, the dancing, the music that they use.
The thing they do with his eyes
digitally
to make him go in slightly different directions.
And the opening scene. I love the opening scene. You know, I didn't expect the kid's arm to get, like ripped off.
They did a great job. They did it beat for beat straight from the book, which is great because it's written so well for the screen.
Yeah. And a little bit later on, we are going to talk about terrifying books. We're going to combine the two things. Like, what's the scariest books you've ever read? But right now, we've got some fascinating facts about your favorite horror movies. See if you know any of these, Tom, and anybody out there. Mm-hmm. If you guys are fans of horror, what are your favorite things about the horror movies that you love? 312-981-7200. Big horror movie coming out tonight. So 312-981-7200. So let's do this. Here's the first little fact. And by the way, if you want to see this entire article, it's from Mental Floss, and they do a lot of these great, topics where they have little facts about things. I love Mental Floss. I loved it when it was an actual magazine, and I love it now even as a website. I love it. Do you know how Mental Floss actually became popular?
No, I didn't even know it was a magazine.
No, it was an actual physical magazine.
I've only ever known
it
as a website.
They've released books. We've had the guys from Mental Floss on several times over the years. Mental Floss was an actual magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And several characters on Friends were showed reading it or leafing through it.
Oh, really?
And that's how people looked at it and went, what is that magazine that Chandler is holding? And it's Mental Floss. So that's kind of how it gained in popularity. I mean, it had a cult following, but when you put something on Friends, because millions and millions of people watch it, it's going to get a lot of exposure. And people were like, what is this Mental Floss thing? You know, and checked out the magazine and went to the website and all that stuff. But they do really fun stuff on the website. All right, are you ready for some fascinating facts?
Hit me.
And if you guys are horror movie fans, it's a big one coming out this weekend. What are the favorite parts of your horror movies? Why do you like them? And if there's got some facts about the ones you like, share it with us. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. How about this one? Count Orlok only blinks once in Nosferatu.
That I have heard.
In the 9 minutes of screen time that Max Schreck has as Count Orlok in the classic Nosferatu from 1922, he blinks only one time near the end of part one. Just one time. How does someone discover that?
I mean, you just got to go through it frame by frame,
I
guess.
You watch it and go, hey, he blinked.
No, no, that wasn't a blink. He just turned.
Here's one. The Exorcist was the first horror film to be nominated for a Best Picture Oscar. The horror genre has never gotten much love from the Academy. There still seems to be a bias against scary movies during award season. The Exorcist, though, earned 10 Academy Award nominations in 1974, including a Best Supporting Actress nod for Linda Blair, who was just 15 years old at the time of the nomination. She was 12 when they shot it. And it was nominated for director and picture and all that stuff. I can't remember. My favorite performance in that movie, and the performances are one of the reasons why that movie is so effective, is because of the performances. Ellen Burstyn is one of my favorite actresses that is on the planet. I love Ellen Burstyn. And I know this sounds weird. When I was a kid, I had a crush on her.
Well,
I had a massive crush on her.
I mean, back, she was in Last Picture Show, correct?
And she was in, the one that did it for me was Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. That was the movie that I was like, ooh.
No, she was hot to trot back in the day.
And she was spectacular. And another reason why Interstellar rules is because she's in it. But my favorite performance, and what I think is the soul of the movie and the core of the movie, is Jason Miller. He plays Father Damien Karras, and he's the heart and soul of the movie. I think the title The Exorcist is not a reference to Father Marin, Max von Sydow, but to me, the exorcist of the title of the movie, you know, is Father Karras. He's going through this crisis of faith. It's a really heartbreaking and really nuanced and beautiful performance, like a really, really great performance.
It was the demons inside him that he was really exercising.
Well, yeah,
in a way.
No, you know? Yeah. I mean, he's getting boozed up, and you know, there's like him and his priest are in the dorm room just getting hammered, and you know, is the guilt over his mother? I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in that performance, a lot of stuff, and then he comes back for the third one. He's great in that too. Okay, so. Yeah, so, you know, in the last horror movie to win Best Picture was Silence of the Lambs, and that was
91.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we got the award in 92, but it was in 91 that it was, so that's a long time. Was Black Swan nominated for Best Picture? Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Black Swan's a horror movie. I don't care what anybody says. It's a horror movie. So at least that was nominated, but you don't get a lot of horror nominations. It's like comedy and horror. No respect from the awards world.
Yeah, there's a total bias against any sort of genre movie. Every once in a while, I'd say once in a generation or so, you get something like The Lord of the Rings, which just has such crossover appeal.
Yeah.
But even that, they treat it like, oh, but this is literary. This is like one of the great pieces of literature being adapted, so we have to do it. Right. They see it as more something like, you know, Zhivago, or how do you say it?
Zhivago.
Zhivago.
You know,
it's a literary adaptation.
The year that I mooned the TV because Chariots of Fire won Best Picture, you know what else was nominated that year?
What?
Besides, Reds was the one that I was upset about.
Yeah. Because
Reds is a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. It is a great film. You've seen Reds, right?
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary piece of work.
Better than Chariots of Fire, for sure.
Oh, my God. It's not even close. That's why I mooned the TV. another movie that was nominated that year, as we're talking about, you know, like a genre movie, Raiders was nominated that year. The most popular movie of that year, the most beloved movie of 1981 in for most people. And a bunch of British guys running around in their underwear in slow motion. That wins.
Well, horror always wins out in the end because it's still to this day some of the most profitable movie making because the cost floor is so low. It costs virtually nothing to make a great horror movie.
Yeah, well, that's true. But in the case of It, Chapter 2, they're paying some actors. That's a big payroll right there with the names that they have in that movie.
Yeah, you don't get Jessica Chastain on the cheap.
You know the kid, what's the kid's name from who was in It? He played Kevin? He was these. What's his name? Finn? Whatever his name is from
Finn
Stranger.
Finn Wolfhard?
Yeah.
I just call him Stranger Things.
Okay, Stranger Things dude was in it. And Bill Hader was on The Daily Show last night with Trevor Noah, and it was fantastic because Bill Hader rules the planet. And he told a story about how, because he plays the older version of that character in Chapter 2. He plays the older version of I think his name is Kevin. I can't remember. So the director asked who Finn, what's his name? Finn Balor.
Not the amazing wrestler.
He's a wrestler.
the Irish warrior.
He's fantastic. I love that guy.
Finn Wolfhard.
Yeah, Finn Balor. No, it's Finn Balor. He plays
a 12-year-old kid.
And he suplexes the clown. Anyway, so Finn Wolfhard, what's his name? Wolfhard?
Yes,
okay.
Correct.
I was going to say Wolfgar, but that's you know what Wolfgar is? That's Rutger Hauer's name in Nighthawks.
Rutger Hauer as a 12-year-old boy.
That's right. Suplexing Pennywise. So anyway, the director asked Finn who he thinks should play him as an older person, and he immediately said Bill Hader. That kid got Bill Hader the job. Like, they called him. They called him because Finn Balor, Winfield, Wolfgar, recommended that he wanted. The kid was like, no, it should be nobody but Bill Hader should play me as an adult.
And to be fair, knowing that, so this, the character's name is Richie Tozier.
Oh, it's Richie. Okay,
and he's
right.
He's the one who's always cracking wise. Like, right. He's always kind of like masking his fear with humor.
Yeah.
And I honestly, Finn had a pretty prescient, like,
oh no,
Bill Hader's perfect for that type of character.
No, there's no question about it. And you know what is that kid, 12? Well, he's older now.
He's
right?
older now. Yeah. He's gone through the puberty.
I just keep picturing the. I don't know why I keep picturing all those kids from season one. Still,
he's got like a dirt stash in season.
He does.
Three of Stranger
he does.
Things.
Yeah. And Millie Bobby Brown is like 15 now, and she's turning into a really lovely young woman.
Yeah.
And I just look at these kids now and I'm like, oh, well, yeah, kids do grow up, Nick, you moron. But anyway, that kid got him the job. And so Hader tells the story. He's like, his agent calls him and says, yeah, the director from It Chapter 2 wants you to play Richie. And he's like, oh, okay, cool. And then he found out how it happened, and it was Finn Wolfgar, or whatever the hell his name, Wolfland.
Wolf cop.
Werewolf. Who recommended him, and Bill Hader's like, oh, wow. And then he looks into the camera, and the Daily Show, he looks at the camera and goes, that kid is so powerful.
It's so true, man.
Yeah.
When you're on, like, one of the flagship original shows for Netflix, you can...
So you can thank Little Richie for casting Bill Hader. All right. So we're talking about some great facts about our favorite horror movies, and if you want to jump in here, it's 312-981-7200. Really big, and wait till the box office comes back on Monday morning when we talk to Eric about the box office. It's going to be insane. The numbers that this movie's going to make, it's going to be huge. All right, so we're going to take a break. Great facts and fun facts about horror movies, and what movies do you love in that genre, and why do you love them? And that's what we're talking about.
Live for a thousand years, but if I hurt you, I make wine.
All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories about beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. That finishes up the NXS triple play, and we'll move on to another one. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on 720 WGN. And we are talking about facts, fascinating facts about our favorite horror movies. We got a ton of facts here about them. We're talking about horror movies in general because a really big one is coming out. And we want to hear from you guys. Did you like It? Are you looking forward to It Chapter 2? That's the really big movie of the week. We want to hear from you. Talk or text. Phone text lines are wide open at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Mark the Breadman texts in. Just watched the original It last week. Definitely has not aged well, but Tim Curry does a fantastic job, and I can't wait for Chapter 2. I have not seen the miniseries in a long time. I remember not really liking the miniseries, but loving Tim Curry.
I think that's what most people would say upon revisitation.
Because I had read the book, and I love the book. I read the book, and I was disappointed with, you know, the handling of the rest of the story, but I thought Tim Curry was great.
Yeah, I would say if you had to choose which half of the miniseries, the stuff with the kids is definitely stronger.
Yeah.
In that one. And the very end, I mean, it's made for TV, but when the big spider thing, yeah, when you find out the true form,
yeah,
yeah, that does not look
great. No, it
doesn't.
Great. It doesn't.
But it was a made for ABC.
It was. It was a made for ABC miniseries. And, but, you know, the thing is about, like I was just saying about Tim Curry, Tim Curry is great in everything. Everything. Even terrible movies, he's great in. He's great in Legend. He's by far the best thing in that movie. Well, I don't think this is a bad movie, but he's great. He's great in Congo. He's fantastic in Congo, which is a movie that the only person that didn't know it was a comedy was the director. Frank Marshall was not aware that it was a comedy. The actors were. John Patrick Shanley, who wrote it, who adapted it, was. That movie rules. I love Congo. And, of course, what can you say about Rocky Horror?
I mean, it's iconic.
It's one of the most iconic performances of all time. And of course, Clue.
Yep.
So he's great, Tim Curry. 301 area code says, I enjoy all kinds of horror films. My favorites are the ones that are scary rather than gross, and I prefer the more subtle ones like The Changeling or the original Haunting. Yeah, both of those are great. Those are great haunted house movies.
I can't believe I hadn't seen The Changeling until this year. It's
so good.
It was legitimately terrifying.
It's really scary. It's really scary. Ball bouncing down the stairs.
Yeah.
Like,
And the seance.
The seance scene, like I said, until Hereditary came out, it was the scariest seance scene in film history. But Hereditary is the scariest seance scene that I've ever seen. And again, that's one of the reasons because we're talking about how the Academy really doesn't give a lot of love to horror. Toni Collette gave the best performance of last year, without question. 2 years ago, sorry. 2 years ago. And didn't get a nomination. That's one of my favorite performances. Like it's one of my favorite performances ever, and certainly one of the best performances in horror film in the horror film genre ever.
She gave it her all, man.
Yeah. 708 area code says action doesn't get any respect from the Oscars either. Well, Mad Max won 6 Oscars. It won the most of any movie that year. It didn't win Best Picture. It should have, and it didn't win Best Director. It should have, but it didn't. But all of the technical awards it was nominated for, it won. I mean, it won the most Oscars that year. Now, I remember I was on Cochran's show because people know how I feel about, you know, Fury Road. And they laughed at me. They scoffed at me when we were talking about the Academy Awards. They scoffed at me and I said, you know, there's a chance that Mad Max might win. And they're like, there's no way it's going to win. And like, and half of the crew, I would say 3/4 of the crew of Cochran's show at that time had not seen Fury Road. And they were just making fun of me because it's me. And I said, I'll tell you what, it will win at least 5 Academy Awards, and it did. And at one point, it won like 5 in a row.
Yeah,
like during the broadcast,
weird.
I was like, what the hell? And it got me thinking, I was like, you know, because it won all those, and it was a Mad Max, and you kept hearing the theme, and they're walking up. And it got me thinking, you know what, George Miller might win. George Miller just might win Best Direction. He didn't. But yeah, it fooled me into thinking that there was a chance that Best Director and Best Actor, or Best Director and Best Picture were going to go to Mad Max Fury Road. It didn't, though. So, you know, another action movie that, and again, you're right, the action genre does not get the love that it deserves in some ways. I mean, if you're talking like big, dumb action movies, yeah. But like French Connection's an action movie. And French Connection swept the Academy Awards. It won all the major stuff. So it happens. All right, here's another fascinating fact about our favorite horror movies. Robert Englund was not the first choice to play Freddy Krueger. Did you know this? Do you know who was?
I don't remember who was, but I sat down and watched all of Never Sleep Again.
Right, I've
seen
it.
And I remember they mentioned it. But I can't remember who it was.
Wes Craven reportedly planned to have a stuntman play the seemingly immortal youth hater known as Freddy Krueger, but wisely opted to go with an accomplished actor for the role instead. But his first choice wasn't Robert Englund, who obviously that's his signature role. He was great in that series, but Wes Craven wanted British character actor David Warner. You'll no doubt recognize him from Time Bandits and Titanic. He's been in Star Trek movies. He was in Straw Dogs, Time After Time. He's been in a million things.
Yeah, and he's a scary-looking dude.
He's also a great actor.
That is true.
He's also he played Jack the Ripper in Time After Time, which is one of my favorite movies.
He's in The Omen.
Yeah, he gets his head cut off. He's the guy who gets his head cut off with a sheet of glass.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he wanted him to play that part. Can't imagine anybody, you know, other than Robert Englund. But David Warner's a great actor. Would have been interesting to see what his take was. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We can also imagine Jackie Earle Haley.
But not a terrible choice.
No, not a bad choice, but it just a terrible movie.
Yeah.
And there was no reason to remake it. Okay, we're going to break here, and the news is up after this. Oh, I love it when Cheap Trick is chosen on Triple Play Thursday. That means we get to hear three Cheap Trick songs. By the way, they opened for ZZ Top last night.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, they opened for ZZ Top.
Yeah, my cousin's boyfriend was playing with Rick Nielsen not too long ago.
Where?
I can't remember. He was doing like this Fab Four thing. Where Rick Nielsen with some other musicians would play like Beatles covers.
Well, sure.
And I mean, it was kind of a while ago now, but he invited my cousin's boyfriend to go play because he's a really good guitarist. And Rick Nielsen even lent him a guitar.
So, wow. Hey, well, he's got plenty of them.
Yeah, he's one of those guys.
Yeah. Who requested the Cheap Trick?
It's coming to us from Rich.
All right, Rich. Nice choice. Welcome back, everyone. 312-981-7200. Yeah. We are here until 5 a.m. It is Triple Play Thursday. That is Triple Play Thursday. That's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. And we're back. It, Chapter 2. Looking forward to it. Did you like the first one? That's the big horror movie that's opening tonight. So I'm telling you about some fascinating facts about our favorite horror movies. And we got many, 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 many more to go. But if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Talk and text, 312-981-7200. Here's Patrick on WGN. Hey, Patrick.
Hey.
Hey.
Dude, I love your shows.
Thanks.
I mean, I'm a night guy, and I do not get freaked out by a lot of stuff, and I don't understand. I literally lost a brother-in-law that literally could not watch a scary movie without being like terrified by it. And I don't get it. I've watched, again, I have four kids. They love to watch those terrifying movies, and I don't get it. I don't get scared from it. And they're like, you know, I've got a couple daughters that like, oh, after they watch a scary movie, they're like, we got to keep the lights on in the bedroom. And I don't get it.
Okay.
is it me, or is it like,
I think it is you, but that's just me. Here's the thing, that some people just don't get as scared at horror movies that other people do. But everybody is scared everybody is scared of something, and that you can't deny. Everybody is scared of something.
I guess it's reality.
Yeah.
Know?
Well,
I mean,
yeah, but everybody is scared of something. When a movie taps into fears that people have, like primal fears, they can be scary. Now, I'm not scared by, you know, I would say a lot of the horror movies I see, they don't scare me. I think they're awesome. Some of them are kind of creepy. Some of them get under my skin. And some of them completely scare the crap out of me. It just depends. But I like all kinds of horror movies. But the ones that really stick with me are the ones that, like, are usually really sort of intensely effective or tap into something that is primal and freaks me out. And that's why Hereditary freaked me out. And, you know, I mean, there are certain movies that just, like, The Exorcist freaks people out because, you know, especially you know, Catholics, they were freaked out by that movie, like big time. Yeah. So if it taps into something primal, but yeah, I mean, first of all, I love scary movies. And if you don't get scared by them, God bless you. My parents went to go see The Exorcist with another couple. And my mom told me the story about how the guy in the couple laughed through the whole movie. He laughed through The Exorcist. And Exorcist 3 is a movie that freaks me out. That scares me. And I like to be scared. You know, you live vicariously through that because the world's all screwed up. There's plenty of stuff to be scared about without watching a movie. So, you know, to experience something scary and know that it's not real is fun and also scary. But I would rather, you know, not be scared by something that's happened in the real world. It's impossible because every day something terrifying happens. But that's how we deal with it. Watch these movies. At least that's how I do. Patrick, thanks for the call. 312-981-7200. Let's see. I love this little fact. This is a fascinating fact about horror movies, and this is one of my favorites. Psycho is the first American film to feature a toilet.
Yeah. I reference this often.
Yeah, I love it. I love that. It's the first movie flushing. To show a toilet. You would hear a toilet flush in movies. It was also the first American film where you heard a toilet being flushed. So it was the first one to show a toilet and the first one to hear a toilet flush. And then that became a punchline, like especially on All in the Family. Where's Archie? You'd hear the toilet flush and that would get like a huge laugh.
Yeah. Do you know what they used for the blood in the shower scene?
Hershey syrup.
Yeah.
Yeah. Todd Browning's Freaks me out and the original Omen. Yeah, the Omen, when I was a kid, the Omen freaked me out. It doesn't anymore. I like it. But when I was a kid, it freaked me out.
The bit where the lady hangs herself still, like...
That's probably the creepiest part of the movie.
It's all for you, Damien!
Yeah. That's probably the creepiest part of the movie. But
when they go to the zoo and the animals are, like, going nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, it just doesn't... It just... I mean, when I was... Because when that movie came out, I think I was 11. You know, and obviously I saw it in the theater because at that point I was seeing everything in the theater. And I remember being freaked out by, you know, like certain scenes being really freaked out and especially freaked out by the music. And the music is still one of my favorite horror. Yeah. Jerry Goldsmith is one of my favorite horror scores.
Oh, God, it's so good.
708 says, of course, my favorite horror movie is An American Werewolf in London. The first horror movie to ever combine dark humor. It's not true. It's not the first.
Yeah.
It's not the first. There were a lot of horror movies before that had a comedic element to them. A lot of them. The backstory was that while Rick Baker was shooting the movie, Steven Spielberg stole his designs for a movie called Night Skies about aliens and used it for E.T. Um, 815 area code says, in an early scene of Zack Snyder's remake of Dawn of the Dead, a helicopter flies through the shot that's the same helicopter that the characters flew in the original. So they brought out the actual helicopter that Flyboy flew in Romero's version. And Exorcist 3 has the greatest jump scare in the history of movies, and you know the scene I mean. Yeah. It is truly, truly one of the most brilliantly executed jump scares of all time. And also the image of the dude with the white hood and the cloak with the garden shears in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty creepy image. There's a lot of creepy stuff in that movie. Exorcist 3 is a really creepy movie. It's a very scary movie. All right, I think we all know this fact about horror movies. Stephen King was not a fan of The Shining. I think we all know that. 1983, Stephen King told Playboy, I admire Stanley Kubrick for a long time and had great expectations for the project, but I was deeply disappointed in the end result. Parts of the film are chilling, charged with a relentlessly claustrophobic terror, but others fell flat. King did not like the casting of Jack Nicholson either, claiming Jack Nicholson, though a fine actor, was all wrong for the part. His last big role had been One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and between that and the manic grin, the audience automatically identified him as a loony from the first scene. That's true. The book is about Jack Torrance's gradual descent into madness through the influence of the Overlook. If the guy was nuts to begin with, then the entire tragedy of his downfall is wasted. I got to agree. Listen, I love The Shining. I do. But Nicholson's nuts from the get-go. He's nuts from the get-go.
See, I always read it as there's just something a little off about him. Like, there's the seed of madness. Because people don't just go mad.
Yeah.
There's a seed of madness. And I think that Kubrick's Shining did capture that in the sense that everybody's already a little bit crazy. It just takes a few things to send you over the edge.
And see, now that's another movie. We were just talking with the listener, Patrick, who says he doesn't get scared by horror movies. The Shining doesn't scare me.
It drives me crazy. Like, it makes me question my sanity. That's what it makes me do.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. I think the only scene in the movie that was like, whoa, was the twins in the hallway. That's the only scene, like the only moment in the movie where I went, ugh.
I always get freaked out by the lady in the bathtub.
The lady in the bathtub.
When he pulls her out and then she decays. Yeah. Like, that freaks me out real bad.
But it doesn't, I mean, I don't know. And I love the movie. I do. I love it. Yeah. And what's this called? Dr. Sleep? Dr. Sleep.
I think it looks great. It's Mike Flanagan.
I think it looks great, too. And like I said before, I'm wondering how Stephen King is going to feel about it, considering that it's a complete sequel to the movie, even using scenes from the movie and music cues from the movie.
I mean,
he hates the movie.
I think at this point, Stephen King recognizes that Kubrick's The Shining is considered the definitive representation of that story in people's minds.
Yeah.
Because many people have not read the book. They've seen the movie The Shining, and it's iconic. So I think Stephen King is actually being really smart and being the bigger man and just saying, you know what? If you're going to make a film sequel to The Shining, it has to use the Kubrick imagery. Otherwise, people are not going to accept it as a full sequel.
Jaws doesn't fully appear in a shot until 1 hour and 21 minutes into the movie. That's because it didn't work.
Good old Bruce.
Bruce did not work. That's what they called the shark. With the lack of shark appearances, while the lack of shark appearances works to heighten the tension in Jaws, the real reason is that the shark isn't shown in full is because the mechanical shark that was already built rarely worked during filming. Director Steven Spielberg had to create inventive ways like Quint's yellow barrels to shoot around the non-functioning movie shark. Well, I think it makes the movie all the more effective. I think it works. I think a lot of people think it works. That movie's only, an unmitigated classic. I love this story. Love this story. Faye Ray thought she was going to be co-starring opposite Cary Grant in King Kong. Did you know this?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
In his attempts to entice Faye Ray into starring in King Kong in 1933, director Marion C. Cooper promised, "You're going to have the tallest, darkest leading man in Hollywood." That's what he said to her. While my thoughts were flying around toward the hope that Cooper might be waiting for Cary Grant's arrival, just as I was, Cooper went on to point out that the giant ape and say, yeah, again, that's it. That's the tallest, darkest leading man in Hollywood.
That is, she got.
That was hilarious.
That's funny
she
as hell.
She thought it was Cary Grant, and it was the big ape. It took 7 years to get Aliens made. Why did it take 7 years to get a sequel made? Lawyers and money, of course. Talk of a sequel began shortly after Alien, the original Alien in 1979, was a hit. But it was delayed because of a dispute between the film's producers and 20th Century Fox over the distribution of the original film's profits. Fox, reluctant to make a sequel because it would be too expensive, finally agreed to it as a way of settling the beef with the producers. We won't give you any more of the first film's profit, but we'll greenlight a sequel and you can make money from that. Amusingly, the same producers plus James Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd sued Fox again after Aliens, claiming that the studio had used creative accounting techniques to avoid paying them.
That's not the first time that, or it wouldn't be the last time that Gail Ann Hurd would be caught up in one of those.
Yeah.
Because the whole thing with The Walking Dead.
Right.
And I think I have to correct myself on something I said a long time ago about Alien. I was insistent that Dan O'Bannon was really the one, was like, yeah, he wrote the script. This is his creation. Apparently was really a lot of Walter Hill.
Yes,
it really was. And I didn't believe it. I was like, maybe he did some doctoring. And then I did not realize how much people really kind of hated Dan O'Bannon. Like, you either liked him or you hated him.
Carpenter's relationship with him during and especially after Dark Star, because Dan O'Bannon was a guy who, you know, not to speak ill of the dead, because he was a talented guy.
Yeah, he gave us Return of the Living Dead.
He gave us Return of the Living Dead, and he has co-written or written, been a part of some of the classic genre movies that I love. But he was a guy who took a lot of credit for stuff that he didn't do. And that's especially true of Dark Star. Like, he took credit for so much on Dark Star. And Carpenter kept his mouth shut. He was like, you know what, all right. So, anyway. But he was funny in Dark Star. He's hilarious.
Yeah.
Pinback is great. So, all right. We're going to break here. And It, Chapter 2, you're looking forward to it. Do you love It? We're going to get to really scary books as well. But we're talking about some unbelievable, fascinating facts about horror movies. If you know some behind-the-scenes stuff or some facts or movies that you love, why you love them, we want to hear from you. Welcome back, everybody. Cheap Trick on Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man. Yeah. Triple Play Thursday, if you want to jump in with your requests. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. That is, of course, Cheap Trick with Big Eyes. Big movie release this week happens to be a horror movie, a sequel to a very, very popular and very, very scary horror movie. Based on a Stephen King novel called It. So It Chapter 2 is coming out, and we're talking about some fascinating facts behind some of our favorite horror movies. And we want to hear from you about some of your favorites and why you like them, and if you know some facts behind them. We'd love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. How about this? Brian De Palma didn't see Sissy Spacek as Carrie. Though Brian De Palma was a fan of Sissy Spacek's work, he was convinced that he had already found Carrie in another actress. His decision to let Spacek audition at all was mostly out of courtesy to her husband, Jack Fisk, who was the movie's art director. He told me that if I wanted to, I could try out for the part of Carrie White, Spacek recounted to Rolling Stone. There was another girl that he was set on, and unless he was really surprised, she was the one. I hung up and decided to go for it. Spacek showed up to her audition in an old dress she hadn't worn since grade school with her hair slicked back in Vaseline. When she was done, she waited in the parking lot while her husband reviewed her audition with the rest of the production team. After Fisk came out and to tell her that the part was hers, we sped off before anybody could change his mind. And I can't remember who the other actress was. It's somebody that probably not as well known, but we know who she is. He had decided on somebody else. And Sissy Spacek, to be fair, Sissy Spacek was too old to play the role. To be fair.
Yeah, realistically.
She was too old to play the role. But she's great in it. How about this? Roman Polanski and John Cassavetes had different ideas for Rosemary's Baby. In her 1997 autobiography, What Falls Away, Mia Farrow recounted the tense relationship between Roman Polanski and her Rosemary's Baby co-star, writing in that the film's climactic scene, John became openly critical of Roman, who yelled, "John, shut up," and they moved towards each other and nearly came to blows. Apparently, it was Ruth Gordon and her consummate professionalism that calmed the situation down.
What I wouldn't have given to know... John Cassavetes kicked the crap out of Roman Polanski.
Would have killed Roman Polanski.
Oh, my God. He was a man. Like, John Cassavetes was
John
a
Cassavetes.
Man. And apparently, was Amy Irving?
I know Amy Irving. Here's the thing. I know Amy Irving. Well, Amy Irving's in Carrie.
She is.
I know Amy Irving, you know, auditioned for the... Maybe it was Amy Irving, and then Amy Irving just got... She got Sue Snell instead, which is a great role. But that was the thing. During that audition process, Brian De Palma and George Lucas George Lucas was casting Star Wars, and so they saw a lot of the same actors. Like, a bunch of those people who ended up in Carrie had auditioned for Star Wars, and a bunch of the people that auditioned for Star Wars had auditioned for Carrie and vice versa.
Now, Movie Phone claims, now this is Movie Phone claims, that De Palma picks Sissy Spacek over Carrie Fisher.
Okay, maybe it was Carrie Fisher.
So it could have it could have been either Amy Irving or Carrie Fisher.
Yeah, I would, you know what? Actually, I would lean towards Carrie Fisher, because if I were Amy Irving and, you know, well, maybe he didn't tell, he probably didn't tell her.
Mm.
And she got the part of Sue instead. So either one of them is plausible. But, you know, so Carrie Fisher didn't get Carrie, but she only got Princess Leia.
Yeah, only.
Tim is on WGN. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Nick. How are you, man?
All right. What's up?
Well, first of all, I'm just as excited about that, the It Chapter 2, that you are. I got the first one, and I loved every second of it. I didn't see it in the big theater, which I regret.
Yeah.
But I'm absolutely going to see Part 2. If for no other reason, because Jessica Chastain's in it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. No, I'm with you, man. I'm totally with you.
Yeah, but the whole horror thing, I was never much into it. But a few years ago, you had a Saturday screening. I don't know if you've done them since. The screen movie club. It was a Scarface.
Yes.
And I could go to it because it was on a Saturday, and I work very early. I'm a truck driver, so I'm up very early with you guys every day.
Yeah.
And so I can't go to the screenings on your Tuesday. So I'm like, all right, I'd like to, you know, meet Nick and see Scarface. It'd be kind of cool. I never saw that one. And then you, as you came in to do your introduction, you said, I mean, you were just blown away because you just came from across the hall or something with your parents to, or from The Witch.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, well, I trust Nick's opinion, so I'm going to go check it out. And again, I didn't see that one on the big screen either, but as soon as it came out on Blu-ray, I got it. And just fell in love with it. Every frame of that, and I was attached to for some odd reason.
Yeah.
And it sort of spoke to me, and maybe I'd lived in New England for 10 years, so maybe that had a little bit to do with it.
Yeah.
And, the deepening madness.
This director's next movie is coming out. Actually, we'll probably get a review from it from Eric, because it's playing in Toronto, and Eric Childress is in Toronto right now at the film festival. It's called The Lighthouse. And it's with Robert Pattinson. Yeah, it's with Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe, and it's supposed to be really, really good. Like, yeah, really. And it's, and this one shot in black and white. So,
well, you know, I love that effect too. I mean, there's a lot of The Witch that looks a lot like it's in black and white. Just
The
start, it captures the period,
yep.
And just the whole New England thing and the Puritans and the and oh, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, you know, it's a great film
in the woods. It's great.
It's a great movie.
It turned me on to a bunch of horror films, and I think I've rented out everything at Redbox, you know, and I've seen some really, really bad ones and
yeah.
Some really, really good ones.
Yeah. Well, all right, listen, have fun. Have fun this weekend when you see It, man.
All right, thanks.
All right, buddy, take care. Yeah, The Witch.
That was, that still stands as one of my favorite trailers I've ever seen.
But, you know, people didn't know what to make of that movie in Skokie. I saw it at a multiplex in Skokie. People didn't know what the hell was going on.
My old GM at the 400 hated it so much she threw her shoe at the screen.
Yeah, no, people hated it. It's like it comes at night. People hated that.
It's because they don't know what they're missing, man.
Midsummer, I saw in Skokie at the multiplex. People were like, "What in God's name is happening?"
Is that a bear?
Yeah, but I mean, the thing that's one of the reasons why I love the Skokie Village Crossing Theater, because they have so many theaters there. There's 18 theaters there. They have an IMAX, they have a Dolby, and so they take the little movies. You know
yeah.
what I mean? They show
They've
the,
got the room.
Yeah. But it's so weird to watch people who are expecting, like, The Witch. People were like, what the hell? People had no idea what was going on and
who's,
hated it. People
who's the goat?
It. People hated it. Don't mess with Black Phillip, man.
Nah, man. Live deliciously,
just
baby.
Just want you to live deliciously. All right. We got the news coming up right after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday continues. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And that's, of course, Cheap Trick. We're back, and It Chapter 2 opens this weekend. And so as a result here, we are talking about some fascinating facts about our favorite horror movies. We got some texts coming in, and if you want to call in as well, phone line and text line, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. 608 area code says, my parents told me that they made the mistake of taking her preteen brother to The Exorcist at the drive-in theater. They were babysitting overnight. Preteen brother, I got you beat. I was 8. In the theater. Wasn't at the drive-in. Drive-in's a little safer. 608 area code says, part of The Omen was filmed in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. The second one was filmed here. Lance Hendrickson telling great stories about the extended time that he spent here and in the suburbs where they filmed Damien Omen 2.
Did they do scenes in the Field Museum?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was.
That's where the dude, who's the dude, the African-American dude from Designing Women?
Oh, God.
He's in it, and he plays like a scientist at the Field Museum. He's got the best kill. He's the best kill in the Damien Omen 2. Because in the Omen, they were in the Omen in Damien Omen 2, they were trying to top the murder, the
is
kills.
Meshach Taylor?
That's it, Meshach Taylor.
Yeah.
So in they're trying to top the kills from the Omen in Damien Omen 2. And so obviously the most quality kill in the Omen is David Warner getting his head cut off with the sheet of glass.
Yeah.
So they wanted to do like another let's cut somebody in half, or so they cut what's his face?
Meshach Taylor.
They cut him in half. He's in an elevator, and the elevator starts going haywire and flying down, and the cable that goes across the top of the elevator snaps off and flies through the top of the elevator. He's on the floor of the elevator, and the cable cuts him straight in half, like cuts him right in half. And that scene takes place in the, well, it doesn't. It was shot to imply that it took place in the Field Museum. But yeah, he gets chopped and has the best kill in the movie. 419 area code says, I love Them, and I'm assuming that's the giant ant movie.
I hope so.
Not Eels, with the French film called Them, which is one of the most terrifying movies I've ever seen in my life. That scared the hell out of me, that movie. Mm-hmm. Scared the hell out of me. I was like, I was seriously like, because I have a home invasion phobia.
Were you a fan of The Strangers?
Yeah, but Them is better.
Them is better.
Them is, like, I mean, Strangers came out after it, and I was like, this is basically an unauthorized remake of Them. But I did, I liked The Strangers. I thought The Strangers was fine.
Yeah.
But Them is really, I mean, scary.
Different level.
Scary. Really scary. And also, I mean, to add to that, like, You're Next. I loved You're Next.
You're Next is really good.
Yeah, I have an issue. There was a movie called Hush.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course you know that because it's your last name. And it was directed by Mike Flanagan, if I'm not mistaken. And it was about a deaf woman who's being terrorized by a guy outside of her house and she can't hear him.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one, too. 708 area code. Carrie's hand coming out of the grave. Scariest scene ever. Yeah, it's a
good one.
It's a great one. Grant says, Nick, I'm looking forward to It Chapter 2. Clowns are very freaky, period, especially Captain Spaulding in The Devil's Rejects, written and directed by Rob Zombie. Yeah, I respectfully disagree about Captain Spaulding.
That's not Chop Top, is it?
No. That's, what's his name? It's not Bill Moseley. Bill Moseley plays the other idiot in those movies. It's Sid Haig.
That's it, yeah. I gotta give it to Bill Moseley for Chopped Up.
Oh,
though.
It's legendary.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2.
It's insane.
It's misunderstood.
It's an insane movie.
How could Dennis Hopper in a dual wielding chainsaw battle with Leatherface not light up the audience?
Yeah.
Make it $1 billion.
That my friend Ryan Oliver, who wrote and directed Among the Dead, the play that I was in, that's his all time favorite horror movie.
Hell yeah. Part two. Hell yeah.
I mean, I like Part 2. I think it's fun. It's insane. But the first one is the best. I mean, the first one is legendary.
But it doesn't have Oingo Boingo in it.
Yeah.
When he's chopping up those two college
frat
boys.
It's a certifiably crazy movie. It really is.
So good.
How about this little fact? In 2015, George Romero found 9 minutes of lost footage from the original Night of the Living Dead. While in Maryland at Monster Mania Con in 2015, George Romero revealed that he had unearthed a 16-millimeter print of Night of the Living Dead, which featured approximately 9 extra minutes that was thought to be lost. Here's another fact, right? Now here's this is one that I think a lot of people know. Serial killer Ed Gein inspired 3 major horror movies. You've likely heard of Ed Gein. His House of Horrors made headlines for years after he was sent to a mental hospital for his actions. They were so memorable, in fact, that he inspired some of the most iconic thrillers of all time. He inspired Psycho, The Silence of the Lambs, and The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Among the items discovered at his Plainfield, Wisconsin farm were 4 noses, 9 masks made of human skin, and numerous decapitated heads. Lampshades and bowls made of skin, lips being used to pull on a window shade, and a belt made from nipples. Gein later admitted to only 2 murders and said that most of the items came from late-night cemetery raids. The Halloween script didn't call for a specific kind of mask. Oh, we all know this story. I mean, this is one of the legendary horror film stories of all time. The mask for Michael Myers was described only as having pale, neutral features of a man, quote-unquote. And the movie was designed to be boiled down to 2 options. Both were cheap latex masks, painted white and bought for $2 a piece at a local toy store by production designer Tommy Lee Wallace. One was a replica mask of a clown character called Weary Willie, popularized by actor Emmett Kelly, and the other was a stretched-out Captain Kirk mask from Star Trek. Carpenter chose the whitewashed Kirk mask because of its blank stare that perfectly fit Mike Myers, too. Now, Tommy Lee Wallace is legendary for this because he brought a clown mask and he brought the Captain Kirk mask. And so what he did was he took the Captain Kirk mask and he cut the eye holes, made the eye holes bigger, really screwed up the hair, like started pulling hair out and teasing it up, and then he spray painted it white. And that's one of the most iconic masks in movie history was a $2 Captain Kirk mask that the eye holes were cut out, the hair was messed up, and it was spray painted white. That's all Tommy Lee Wallace is doing. That's the kind of money they had for a production design of Halloween. $2 mask and some spray paint and scissors.
Hey, simplicity can create great things.
Yeah, and it did. I mean, it's legendary. Oh, I love this. I love this. The Babadook scared the hell out of William Friedkin. On November 30th, 2014, Jennifer Kent's The Babadook got a major publicity boost when The Exorcist director William Friedkin tweeted, "I've never seen a more terrifying film than The Babadook. It scared the hell out of it will scare the hell out of you as it did me." See, when you get like that, like when The Evil Dead came out, the original Evil Dead, it got a quote from Stephen King. Like the most ferociously original horror film I've ever seen. That's what he said about Evil Dead. And they slapped that on the poster. And the poster, by the way, the iconic poster for Evil Dead has nothing to do with the movie. Nothing. The person's not in the movie. That scene, that image never happens in the movie. So they've got this image that's not in the movie, and they got a quote from Stephen King. And then, obviously, the cult status began to take off. So, let's see, here's Donald on WGN. Go ahead, Donald.
Hi, yeah. How about nuclear horror? And I'm specifically thinking about the all-time great nuclear horror of The Day After.
Yeah, I remember when The Day After was shown, the next day in school, I was in high school, they were asking people if they wanted to see counselors. If they watched it, because you know, all of America was freaked out by it.
Yeah, and that's pretty because it could happen. I mean, yeah. And it actually has in Japan. So
right.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yep. Okay, Donald. Thanks, man.
Mm-hmm.
All right. How about this one? A double amputee was used to create the Thing's quintessential special effect. One of the most memorable scenes in John Carpenter's The Thing, often referred to as the chest chomp scene, occurs when Dr. Copper, played by Richard Dysart, attempts to revive Norris, played by Charles Hallahan, with a defibrillator. As he presses the paddles to the patient's skin, Norris' chest opens up and Copper's forearms disappear into the cavity, where they are severed below the elbow by the jaws inside of Norris's chest. In order to pull this off, special makeup effects designer Rob Bottin, known for his work at RoboCop, Total Recall 7, and Fight Club, found a man who had lost both his arms just below the elbow in an industrial accident. Bottin fit the man with 2 prosthetic forearms consisting of wax bones, rubber veins, and jello. And then, at a wide-angle shot, he fit the man with a skin-like mask taken from the mold of Dysart's face. and placed the fake arms into the chest cavity where a set of mechanical jaws clamped down on them. As the actor pulled away, the jello arms severed below the elbows, and the rest is practical effects history. Rob Bottin, insane.
23-year-old genius.
And insane. Insane. So... All right, let's take a break here for some weather, and we'll come back and we'll wrap up the facts about horror movies, and we're going to jump into scariest books. What are the scariest books you've ever read? Again, in honor of the release of It Chapter 2, that's a scary book, and a lot of people have read some very scary books, and they've made some pretty good movies out of it. And that's what we're going to be talking about after 4 o'clock. But if you want to jump in with some of your horror movie thoughts, behind-the-scenes stuff, we'll get some more facts. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You see a faded sign at the side of the road that says 15 miles to the Love Shack, yeah. I'm heading down the Atlanta Highway. Looking for the love. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, Triple Play Thursday.
Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday.
It's one artist, three songs. Who requested the B-52s?
It's coming to us from our good pal, Jay.
Jay. All right, Jay. Thank you. And welcome back. Hey, coming up at 6 o'clock, Steve Cochran has your morning drive, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on WGN. Okay, so It Chapter 2 comes out tonight officially, and lots of people are going to see it over the weekend. It's going to make a ton of money. It's a follow-up to It from a couple of years ago based on Stephen King's novel, and so we're talking about some facts behind the scenes, some fun facts about horror movies. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to jump in. How about this? The original ending of Fright Night was much different. The film's original ending saw Peter Vincent transform into a vampire while hosting Fright Night in front of a live television audience. I don't like that ending. I loved Roddy McDowall in that movie. God, he's so good. You know, I actually liked the remake. I thought the remake.
So did I.
I liked the remake. I thought Colin Farrell was great.
Colin Farrell was great. David Tennant was hilarious.
David Tennant was hysterical.
So funny.
And then Anton Yelchin, of course.
God love him.
The stars of the Blair Witch Project use GPS trackers to find their instructions for the day. I love everything about the Blair Witch Project. I love the way it was made.
Everything they did.
Everything, man.
It should be illegal, though, because that's like some psychological Stanford prison experiment stuff.
Those two dudes totally screwed with those three people. There's just no question about it. You can see it on the film, too.
Yeah. It gets real there.
It does.
It gets real there for a sec, and that... The ending of that movie still terrifies me to this day.
The final shot is one of the scariest final shots I've ever seen. I don't care. That's a scary movie. I know a lot of people hate it. I don't care. I love it. I think the Blair Witch Project is great. It's a great movie.
Blew minds in 1999.
Oh, yes, it did. I personally knew two people who thought it was real. Like, who actually thought...
Hell, I thought it was real.
Yeah.
Growing up.
Production programmed weight points... they programmed weight points in the GPS unit for the actors to locate milk crates with three plastic canisters in them. Each plastic canister contained notes on where the story was going for each actor, who would not show the other two their paper. From that point, they were free to improvise the dialogue, provided they followed the general instructions that were given to them. And it's never more apparent than when Josh says he threw the map away, like he kicked the map away. The other two, his reaction to that... And they would they were sleep deprived, these three people, and they would be woken up by things outside the tent, like scratching and shaking the tent and noises and stuff. There was like general you know, like genuine sleep deprivation and terror in the eyes of these three these three actors. I love that movie. How about this? Paranormal Activity is the most profitable film of all time. Often compared to The Blair Witch Project because of its low-budget nature and high grosses, 10 years after The Blair Witch Project it was released, the original Paranormal Activity ousted the earlier horror film as the most profitable movie based on return on investment. Blair Witch Project cost about $60,000 to make, whereas Paranormal Activity's initial budget was just $15,000. Blair Witch grossed $248.6 million worldwide, which comes out to a 414,223% range in return on investment. After grossing $65 million, it was calculated that Paranormal Activity made $433,900%. Of course, that doesn't factor into the worldwide gross of $193 million. So,
I think prior to Blair Witch, it had been for a number of years, and correct me if I'm wrong.
It was Halloween.
Oh, really? I thought Mad Max had it for a minute.
No, Halloween had it until Blair Witch.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Horror still so profitable. You need very little to get it done.
Scream was originally called Scary Movie. Yes,
yeah,
it was.
Yeah.
That's where the Wayans got their title for the parody that they did. The original title of the film was Scary Movie, but it was changed to Scream by the Weinstein brothers in the middle of production. They allegedly decided to change because Harvey Weinstein was listening to Michael Jackson's song Scream in his car with his brother Bob. They both liked the title as a horror movie. Okay.
Kevin Williamson did some weird stuff to sell that movie. Like he would send in like a weird cover letter that was just like, yeah, this movie's going to make you a ton of money and I'll make it for like virtually nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true. The Blob is supposedly based on a true story. On September 27, 1950, the Philadelphia Inquirer ran an article with the headline said, Flying Saucer Just Dissolves. The night before, police officers John Collins and Joe Keenan swore they'd watched a mysterious object fall from the sky. Rushing toward the landing site, the men stumbled upon a purple jelly-like mass. Collins and Keenan immediately summoned two of their colleagues who arrived just in time to watch the material evaporate without a trace. The FBI was contacted, a press conference was held, and the whole mess became a national laughingstock. You flash forward to 1957, the year that producer Jack H. Harris was looking to make a creature feature, but he couldn't come up with a decent premise. He asked a friend to try to devise one. It's got to be a monster movie, Harris explained. It's got to be in color instead of black and white, and it can't be a cheapy creepy. It's got to have some substance to it. It's got to have characters that you believe in. Milgate, the screenwriter, remembered the Philly incident, and the rest is history. It's got to have characters that you can believe in. Have you seen The Blob? Joel Cohen got his first break as an assistant editor on The Evil Dead. After becoming an Oscar-winning filmmaking duo, he and his brother Ethan are today, Joel Cohen got his start as an assistant editor on The Evil Dead. Inspired by Raimi's DIY filmmaking, Joel and his brother created a pitch trailer, much like Raimi's Within the Woods, to raise their first money for their first feature, Blood Simple. While Dan Hedaya stars in the final film, Bruce Campbell plays the lead in the 2-minute trailer. Tim Burton was in contention to direct Gremlins. Boy, it would have been a completely different movie had he directed it.
Very much so.
But that was before Pee-wee's Big Adventure. There was a lot of buzz surrounding Tim Burton after the success of his short film Frankenweenie, so much so that Steven Spielberg considered him to direct Gremlins. But the fact that Burton had yet to direct a feature worked against him, and the gig was given to Joe Dante. But a year later, Burton released his first theatrical feature, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Bob Clark's idea for a Black Christmas sequel sounds awfully familiar. Bob Clark has a great legacy for horror movies. Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, Death Dream. But it was Black Christmas, one of the first slasher movies. It became a cult classic and earned him a dedicated following. Clark said in an interview that John Carpenter asked him if he had considered making a sequel to Black Christmas. I was through with horror, Clark explained. I didn't come into the business to just do horror. Carpenter asked him what the sequel would be like if he did it, if he was going to make one. Clark gave him an idea that sounds pretty familiar. I said that it would take place next year. The guy would have actually been caught. He escapes the mental institution, and he goes back to the house to start all over again, and I would call it Halloween. Gene Hackman was slated to star in and direct The Silence of the Lambs. Yeah, he was supposed to play...
You'd be Hannibal Lecter.
Right? He was supposed to play Hannibal Lecter, and he dropped out. Because he watched clips of himself in the 1989 Alan Parker, violent Mississippi Burning, decided he didn't want to follow up a dark role with an even more dark role. And then finally, Child's Play was inspired by a real event. Servants placed a voodoo back in 1909. Key West painter and author Robin Eugene Otto claimed that one of his family servants placed a voodoo curse on a childhood toy, Robert the Doll. Supposedly, the doll would mysteriously roam from room to room, knock furniture over, and conduct conversations with Otto. Robert the Doll was left in an attic until Otto's death in 1974.
Robert the Doll also was voiced by Brad Dourif.
Yeah, exactly. And then later would be voiced by Mark Hamill. So
that Child's Play remake, not too bad.
No, it was pretty good.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
All right. Let's take a break here, and we'll talk about... We're going to continue the scary stuff happening here because of It, Chapter 2 opening, and we're going to talk about scary books. And I'd love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. What are the most terrifying horror books ever? We got some here that we're going to discuss, and we want to hear from you. 312-981-7200. News up after this. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Yeah, we are live in the Skyline studio here on the 18th floor above downtown Chicago. And we're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. And Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6 on this Thursday morning. All right. In honor of It Chapter 2 being released, sequel to It from a couple of years ago, based on the Stephen King novel, we've been talking about fun facts or fascinating facts about horror movies, but now we're moving on to books because obviously It is based on a Stephen King book, and we want to talk about some of the scariest books of all time. So what are some books that really terrified you or really freaked you out? 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. That's the number, and we want to get you in here for talk or text. Yes. All right. Let's see. We already got some texts coming in. 773 area code says, a scary book I read was Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire. It was so enthralling. Old Louisiana brought to life. A truly awesome book. All of the Lestat books are good, but particularly Interview with a Vampire. I'm a big Anne Rice fan. And I love Interview with a Vampire. And I have to say that I was one of those people that was, I had read the book and I was a big fan. I was one of those people who was not thrilled when Tom Cruise got cast. And even Anne Rice was not thrilled. And I was like, man, that's just wrong. And then I saw the movie and I was like, oh, because he's great in it. And Anne Rice actually took out an ad in Variety apologizing and saying that she saw an advanced screening of it. And Tom Cruise is a fantastic Lestat. And she's right. It's a really good movie up until that ending. It's like a great movie, but that, oh my God, that last scene.
Is it different from the book? I never read the book.
Oh, yeah. The ending is ridiculous. The final moment of the movie, like the last 2.5 minutes of the movie, was horrendous. And my ex-wife, my first ex-wife, who was also a big fan, had to remind me that I liked the first 2 hours of the movie. She's like, wait a minute, because I walked out of that theater. I was infuriated. I was infuriated by the end. Oh, man, I was so mad. But I loved everything leading up to it because it's great. And Neil Jordan did a fantastic job. The entire cast was fantastic. But, man, I hated the ending so much. You know, and my ex-wife, my first ex-wife, Wendy, was like, hey, wait a minute. Because, you know, the first 2 hours are great, so shut up. And I was like, yeah, you're right. But as I, you know, and I've seen the film several times, and I still, at the end, I'm like, I just shake my head and go, what in God's name? What were you thinking? And, you know, and I love Neil Jordan. He's one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. But man. 301 area code says, here are some great horror novels. Hell House by Richard Matheson, made into a great movie called The Legend of Hell House with the aforementioned Roddy McDowall. Have you seen Legend of Hell House?
I have.
It's a great movie.
I'm a big Roddy McDowall guy.
Oh, me too. He was one of my heroes. I loved Roddy McDowall. They Thirst by Robert McCammon. Vampires by John Stakely. See, get it? Stakely. Vampires, John Stakely.
Thanks.
Ghost Story by Peter Straub. I've read that. I've read Hell House, too. I haven't read the other two, but I've read Ghost Story by Peter Straub. They made a pretty interesting movie out of that one. Back in the early, I think it was 81 it came out. Fred Astaire was in it. John Houseman. Melvin Douglas. Sorry, Melvin Douglas. Body Double. Craig Wasson was in it. And Alice Krieg. And really beautifully moody movie. It's not... It's kind of faithful to the book, which is one of the complaints that we'll hear as we have this discussion. You know, it's like when it was made into a movie, they did this, they changed that, they moved this around.
Right.
But I still enjoyed the movie. I thought the movie was really good. 312 area code says, Edgar Allan Poe's Black Cat scared me. He's still scary even now. He's my favorite writer. My favorite writer is Edgar Allan Poe. I love everything. I love everything that he's written.
Mm-hmm.
And I started reading Edgar Allan Poe at a ridiculously young age and obviously didn't comprehend a lot of it because it's pretty hefty language in there. But yeah, I remember as a kid reading Edgar Allan Poe and then looking up some of the words in the dictionary. I was like Ione Skye and Say Anything. Remember the scene where he's in her room and they're getting ready to have dinner with her father and the friends, and he's looking around her bedroom while she's getting dressed in the other room, and he goes, "Whoa, this is a monster dictionary," and it's a massive dictionary, and she's like, "Yeah, I've had it forever, and I used to look up words and mark them down," and then she. He starts going through the dictionary. He's flipping through like 500 pages, and there's 80 markings on every page, on every single page.
Yeah, I was always an H.P. Lovecraft kid.
Oh, yeah.
Even though, and I recognize that, at, you know, for who he was, he's a horrible racist.
Yes.
And a maniac.
Yeah.
But that, you know, he carried on what Edgar Allan Poe started and took it to places.
He took it to weirder places. Even.
Yeah. The Color Out of Space is still one of the freakiest stories I've ever read.
You know what's really crazy is that actual adaptations of his stuff, like his stuff, doesn't hold a candle to In the Mouth of Madness, which is not based on an actual piece written by Lovecraft. But it's like the most Lovecraftian movie
because it's like
of all time.
It's like about Sutter Kane is kind of a mixture of Stephen King and H.P. Lovecraft. It's Stephen King's popularity matched with the cosmic sort of horror of H.P. Lovecraft.
The name Sutter Kane immediately brings to mind Stephen King.
Yeah.
It's got the same,
which is weird because they reference Stephen King within the movie. He exists within it. Yeah. So, but yeah, it's In the Mouth of Madness is probably the best Lovecraft adaptation,
even though it's not
Lovecraft.
was Dunwich Horror?
Well, that was adapted into Dagon. Which is,
well,
Usna.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's Stuart Gordon directed Dagon.
Yeah.
Which I liked. And McNaughton did some Lovecraft for the Master. He did the Lovecraft for Master of Horror.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not all the most successful. But Dunwich Horror was actually a movie in the 70s called Dunwich Horror. And I remember liking that movie when I was younger. I haven't seen it in many, 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 many years.
Directed by Daniel Haller.
Yeah. What year? 73, 74?
70.
1970. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I remember seeing that movie when I was a kid. So. All right. Let's see. We got some people on the line. Here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick. How's it going with you, man?
Good.
Yeah, speaking of Stephen King, there's this one book I listened to that really creeped me out, even with the audio book, and this was like the only book that made Stephen King appeal to kids. People are still hoping to make a movie out of it. You ever heard of the Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon?
I do not know that one.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's really good. It's about this little girl who gets lost in the woods. She's a fan of this baseball player named Tom Gordon, and it takes place from there, but people are still hoping for a movie out of it. And yeah. Like I said, it was like the only book that said Stephen King appealed to kids. He even made a pop-up book out of it.
Oh, wow. No, I didn't know that. I'm not aware of that one. But, you know, you know, everybody's hoping for a book. Well, you know, there's a good chance of it because they've made 7,000 movies based on Stephen King stuff, so...
No kidding. Check it out, man.
All right. Thanks, Ike.
No problem.
All right. Here's Jason on WGN. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Good.
I thought the book Jaws was pretty damn scary.
Yeah, I didn't read Jaws till after I saw the movie.
Right, me too. And I'm not a reader. I read it in 2 days. And there were scenes in there with descriptions of the shark going after the little boy.
Yeah.
And Hooper and everything, and when I read it, I was like, that's a pretty scary book.
Yeah, no, it's a scary book. They made some major changes to it, some big-time changes, like Sheriff Brody's wife having an affair. There were all kinds of stuff. Carl Gottlieb wrote the screenplay based on Peter Benchley's book, and Gottlieb made a lot of changes, and he really streamlined it, you know, because it kind of...
There was one thing I was going to say that I saw that Hooper was actually supposed to die in the movie.
Yep.
But the shark scene where the shark got stuck in the cage, they just didn't think they could pull it off then, so they let him live.
Well, the other thing is that they loved him so much. The character was the people loved Richard Dreyfuss so much in that movie. When he pops up at the end, because everybody thinks he's dead. There's that stretch of the movie where you think that Hooper's dead. But when he pops up at the end, every time I saw that movie in the theater, and I saw that movie repeatedly in the theater when it came out, there was a massive round of applause for the fact that Dreyfuss was okay.
I think I was like 7 when it came out.
Yeah.
And we lived in Fort Walton Beach, Florida that summer. My dad was not going to let us go see that movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You live near an ocean, man. So that
exactly.
All right. Okay, Jason. Thanks, man.
Thanks a lot.
See ya. I was 10 when it came out. Made a huge impact on me. You know, people wouldn't even go into Lake Michigan when that movie came out. You know? People wouldn't even go into swimming pools. Like, I'm not going to the swimming pool. There might be a shark in there.
Wouldn't get in the bathtub.
It really freaked people out. Like, I mean, it really, really, really freaked people out.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can really imagine that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a good movie, though. And I read the book afterwards, because after Jaws, you know, I mean, I became obsessed with all things shark. And bought books about sharks and magazines about sharks, and then I bought Jaws and I read it. And it was different, obviously. So, all right, let's break here for some weather, and then we'll jump back in. What are the most terrifying books ever? Barnes & Noble's actually put a blog together and researched and did a whole bunch of and interviewed a bunch of people within the company and outside the company about what they think are the most terrifying horror books ever written. What do you guys think? You like scary books? Because It is coming out again this weekend, and that was a scary book and made into a part one was a scary movie, and part two, we hope, is really scary too. But scariest books, 312-981-7200.
We were at the beach. Everybody had matching towels. Somebody went under a dock, and there they saw a rock. It wasn't a rock.
All right, welcome back. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. We are talking about some of the most terrifying horror books ever made. And this is in honor of the release of It Chapter 2, which is the sequel to It from a couple of years ago, the film sequel, based on the famous Stephen King book of the same name. So we were talking about facts about scary movies and some of your favorites, and then now we are talking about books. We're moving on to some of the scary books. Here's what BarnesandNoble.com says. By the way, if you want to read this entire article with all of the books that are mentioned, It's linked up on our Facebook page. You should like our Facebook page. That's something you should do pretty much now as we speak, right now. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us and follow us now. And everything that's happening on the show also happens on the Facebook page. So you should be a part of it right now. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. The article at BarnesandNoble.com, which again is linked up on our Facebook, says literature can be moving, beautiful, artistic experience. Skilled writers can bring us face to face with scenarios and emotions we might never encounter in real life, expanding our understanding of both the universe and our fellow man. It can also scare the living daylights out of us. Horror novels don't always get the respect they deserve. Just because something is scary doesn't mean that it's not literary or well-crafted. But if the core purpose of a story is perceived to be making you soil yourself in fear, for some reason that story won't get much respect. And again, we were talking about how the horror genre really doesn't get a lot of respect in the movie world, and especially when it comes to awards, particularly the Oscars. And it kind of feels the same way in the literary world. It feels very similar to that. You know, people look down upon Stephen King. Many people look down upon Stephen King, one, because he's a popular writer, like a very, very popular, one of the most popular writers in literary history. And because of the genre in which he writes most of his books. They're not all horror books. Most of them are. The majority of his stories and his novels are scary. But he branches out into other stuff as well. But yeah, people, you know, just, it's like, oh, he sells a lot of books and he's in the horror genre. Yeah, he's not a real writer.
Although I will say there are some of his contemporaries that they don't necessarily work in horror, but they work in different other genre fiction that I really do kind of look down upon, and I don't love their writing.
Mm-hmm.
Like Dean Koontz.
Dean Koontz, not a huge fan of Dean Koontz. But he's written a couple of books that I actually enjoy. But we've got a whole bunch here that we're going to get to. And the first thing that they mention here in the article is this, which I agree with. It says literally everything that Edgar Allan Poe wrote. Poe had a knack for infusing everything he wrote with visceral dread. His characters and narrators tend towards the mentally fragile and insane. People who are haunted by things that might be literal or might be manifestations of their unsound thought processes. Either way, stories like The Telltale Heart and The Cask of Amontillado retained their power to petrify more than a century and a half after their publication because Poe tapped into the fundamental fear that we all have in that world and that people around us are not what they seem. Yeah. You know, the movie versions, they've made many movie versions of Poe's stuff. The stuff that Corman did with Vincent Price was great. Particularly, I mean, I love Tomb of Ligeia. Tomb of Ligeia is my favorite of all of, it's one of my favorite Poe stories. And it's also, I think, my favorite Poe adaptation in that Corman era, Corman Vincent Price era. Of course, Mask of Red Death is great.
Yeah, that's my favorite story is the Mask of Red Death.
It's a great story. It's a great story. And really, really creepy. And just...
And everybody, you know, we all think of Edgar Allan Poe as like the father of the horror genre, but also the father of the detective story.
Oh, no, he invented the detective story.
He invented the detective story with Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Yeah. He invented the detective story, and then that's the angle that they were trying to go with in that stupid movie, The Raven, that Cusack was in. Oh, he invented the detective story. Let's make him a detective.
God.
What a waste that was. All right. Let's see. Here is Jim on WGNI. Jim.
Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Hey, the scaredest I ever was in a book was reading the first 90 pages of Helter Skelter.
Yeah, that's a true story,
yeah. And it was just, I couldn't put it down, and yet I couldn't go back to sleep.
Well, that's the thing about that and the TV movie that they made based on it, because it was true. And when the book came out, it was maybe 4 years after the murders, I think. Three or four years.
72
was the novel, and then the miniseries, I think, was with the TV movie that was based on, the two-part TV movie that was based on, I want to say, was the mid-set, like 75 or 74, something like that. So it was still very fresh in people's minds. The actual, you know, Tate LoBianca murders were very fresh in people's minds, Jim, as you remember.
Yeah.
So that makes it even scarier, because these were real events that didn't happen very long ago, and that made it even more terrifying.
Yeah, and you don't know if he knew that or if he used a writer. Do you know if the prosecutor wrote it himself?
No, he wrote it himself. Yeah,
well, it was him and Kurt Gentry.
Yeah.
So he had help from a journalist and author, but it was mostly it was Vincent Bugliosi basically dictating it and writing most of the details.
Yeah. So, all right, yeah. Jim, thank you.
Have a good one.
All right, take care. Bye. Yeah, that's a scary book.
And Helter Skelter, the book, came out in 1974. The television film was 2 years after that.
So 76.
Yeah, 76.
Yeah, that's the right timeline right there.
And I just finished Helter Skelter because I started reading it for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And he's absolutely right. The first 90 to 100 pages are terrifying.
Yeah, no, it's a really crazy. And the TV movie was scary, too. I remember, the TV movie was 76, so I was 11. And I remember being really, really freaked out by that TV movie. Steve Railsback played Charles Manson in it. And I remember him just being terrifying because it was just such a weird, weird, terrifying story that really happened. And yeah, the book was scary as hell. I read the book after a couple of years. I was a teenager when I read the book. I was probably 12 or 13 when I read the book. So it was about a year or two after I saw the miniseries and a few years after the actual incident. It's scary. It's really, really scary. So, we're talking about scary books. Where you guys stand on this? What are the most terrifying books that you've ever read? 312-981-7200. 773 area code. Tim says, I can't remember the name of the book, but it was in the aftermath of reading that Stephen King novel. For months, I would tense up anytime I would see a flock of birds assembling or gathering on a power line. It freaked me out. 815 area code says Salem's Lot, Stephen King's book, especially when the boy floats up to the boy's window to be let in. Movie not so good. And the movie The Visit, creepy. The Visit, that was M. Night Shyamalan, about the crazy grandparents wanting to stick their grandkids in ovens. Salem's Lot was a good book. I enjoyed it. I actually thought that the first version of Salem's Lot, because they did two versions of it, they were both made for TV. I thought the first one was pretty scary. I thought the first one, which I believe was directed by Toby Hooper. Toby Hooper directed the original miniseries, but there was another miniseries that they made in the 90s with Rob Lowe was in it. And I want to say Donald Sutherland was in it, too. Salem's Lot's a good book. All right, we got a break here, and we've got the news coming up, and then after the news, we're going to jump right back into this. In honor of It, Chapter 2, being released this weekend, we talked about some facts about great scary movies, and now we're talking about great scary books. So if you want to join us, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. News after this.
Sweetness, I was only joking.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is a Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday, yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. And, we're here till 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. In honor of It, Chapter 2, being released this weekend, it's going to be a huge, huge movie, big horror movie. We've been talking about scary stuff this morning. We started talking about great facts behind little facts that you probably didn't know about some classic horror movies. And now we're moving on to books, since It is a book and a movie. And what are the scariest movies, or I'm sorry, the scariest books you've ever read? Barnes & Noble put an article together talking about some of the most terrifying books ever. And we would love to hear from you. Which ones freaked you out? What are scary books that you've read? 312-981-7200. Triple play closing out. Not a triple play. This will be a double play. Who requests? Is that the Smiths or was that Morrissey?
That was the Smiths.
Okay.
And that's coming to us from Amy.
Amy. Is it Amy Guth?
I do not know.
I mean, you know Amy Guth is a nut Smiths and Morrissey fan.
I do know that. Has she ever told you the story when she met Morrissey?
Not when she met Morrissey. She told me when she got kicked in the head. She told me an incident where she got kicked in the side of the head. And nobody should kick Amy Guth in the side of the head because she's a lovely, lovely woman.
Yeah.
But that's weird. If it's not Amy Guth, I don't know, because that's the whenever I hear the Smiths or Morrissey, now, I'm not kidding, now all I think about is Amy Good. That's the first thing that pops into my head is Amy.
That's true. I mean, same thing after I produced for 2 years.
Yeah.
Every time. But, no, ask her, next time you see her, ask her about the time she met Morrissey.
She met Morrissey. She must have freaked out.
She made...
She must have completely freaked out.
She did. She made, like, and she has to do the sound, but apparently she made this sound.
Maybe she did tell me this story.
Yeah,
I don't
remember.
She
made this crazy sound, and when she tells the story, she does the sound, and it's so funny.
Well, she's awesome. I love Amy.
Yeah.
I think Amy Guth is fantastic. I used to get to see her every Saturday.
Yeah.
She followed my show on Saturday evenings. I got to see and I always referred to her as the lovely Amy Guth. That's how I would introduce her all the time when we would do crosstalk. But I think she's great. But I don't know. You know, it's just funny that it's probably another Amy. I don't think Amy Guth is up at 4:30 in the morning.
No.
Right? I would imagine she's probably asleep. But I think, is it only that Amy's like Morrissey?
Who knows?
No, actually, it's the gay Latino that's his biggest following.
Is the gay Latino pop? Oh, because have you ever heard of Mexorcy?
Yes.
Oh, they're
but
great.
But no, wait. Do you not know this?
No, I guess.
Oh, man. No, that's the biggest. It's the biggest group of fans that he has. And Chuck Klosterman wrote a fantastic story in one of his collections about him following that around. And I mean, that is like the core of his audience. Is like Latinos and gay Latinos in particular.
I got to read that piece.
I can't remember what collection it's in, but it's in one of the Klosterman. You know, it's in one of the Klosterman collections.
And that guy writes about pop culture.
Oh, I love him. He's great. Had him on the show like 3 or 4 times. He's fantastic. I love his writing. I love his style. But yeah, that's when I found out about it because I didn't know. I didn't know that. Like, I mean, seriously, it's the major core of his fan base are Latinos and particularly gay Latinos.
They're probably pretty disappointed in him now. He's saying some things.
Yeah,
animals have rights, but not people.
Yeah, but no, he's But anyway, the first person that I think of every time I hear the Smiths is Amy Guth. So, I think it's funny that someone named Amy requested those songs. All right. We are talking about scary books. Chapter 2, is coming out this weekend based on a very scary book. And we want to talk about what your favorites. What are the most terrifying horror books that you've read? 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Here's Hillary on WGN. Hi, Hillary.
Hi, Mac. I've been listening to you for years.
Thank you.
You know, I'm in Pennsylvania, but sometimes the signal is a little dicey. But, you know, I heard in between all the static and stuff. But Rosemary's Baby, that book, and the movie is, you know, Ruth Gordon is amazing.
Yeah,
love her.
I never read the book. I've seen the movie. I've seen the movie several times, and the movie's really scary and really cool.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I never read the book.
For some reason, I don't know. The books seem to be scarier. I mean, I read it twice, and I had to bring my attack pussycat. I had to go to the kitchen for some reason, and it really freaked me out. I thought Pennywise is going to pop out somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, I enjoy your show.
Thank you, Hillary. Okay, thank
you. Bye.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. Rosemary's Baby by Ira Levin. Have you ever read the book?
I have not read the book.
Yeah, neither have I. I don't know why I haven't.
It's one of those, you know, it's one of those things. There's always a list of books like, man, why have I not read this? Or, you know,
yeah.
Even though you enjoy the thing, especially if it's an adaptation. Like, I've never actually read The Shining.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you haven't?
No, I've never read The Shining.
Wow.
There's a lot. I mean, there's so much Stephen King, but there's a ton of Stephen King I've never read.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't, I've not read everything. Yeah. Well, the next one that they talk about here is The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. When you think about cliches of horror fiction, the haunted house is at the top of the list, an idea done so often it frequently is an unintentional parody. Shirley Jackson, however, was no ordinary writer. When she takes on the concept of the haunted house, she perfects it. The Haunting of Hill House is simply the best haunted house story ever written. The scares come not from just the malevolent actions of the house that seem sentient and angry, But from the claustrophobia we experience from the novel's unreliable narrator, Eleanor, whose descent into madness is slow and excruciating and only begins after she's been lulled into a false sense of security by the seeming relatability of her early persona. Yeah. Shirley Jackson has written, some great stuff, including great short stories and great books just in general. Yeah, she was a terrific writer. Terrific writer. All right. Let's see. Got some more texts here. And we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200 with your thoughts on really scary books. 815 area code says, Misery terrified me. Yeah, I liked Misery. I didn't love it. And I thought the movie was well acted, particularly by Kathy Bates, who obviously won an Academy Award. And that was a comeback for James Caan. He hadn't done a movie in a while. He had another comeback earlier, a few years before that, called Alien Nation.
Yeah.
Where he was teamed up with Mandy Patinkin, an alien cop. And it's a good movie. And then it became a TV series on Fox, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, I mean, I like the book. I like the movie. Not one of my favorite of either adaptation or book by Stephen King. 630 area code, Francis Sternhagen, Cliff's mom. Cliff's mom. She's an actress. She's an actress, for the people who don't know. She played Cliff's mom on Cheers. So she was. I love that. That's the way she's been described. That's also my favorite. I was talking about Strother Martin one time. Legendary character actor. What we've got here is a failure to communicate. He's been in a million movies, a bunch of westerns, a ton of classic movies. Some guy called in and said, and he was trying to remember the name of the movie. He couldn't remember the name of the movie. And he's like, it's got Chong's dad in it.
Yeah.
Because Strother Martin plays Tommy Chong's dad in Up in Smoke. In one of my favorite scenes in film history. He's in one scene. He's in the movie for like 2.5 minutes, maybe. He plays Tommy Chong's dad. Now, here's a guy who's been in some classic movies, Strother Martin, including Cool Hand Luke. And Slapshot. He's in Slapshot, too. But this guy just calls in and goes, yeah, it was a movie with Chong's dad.
Well, it's like, what do you always call Thomas Jane?
Oh, but Todd from Boogie Nights.
Todd from Boogie Nights.
Yeah. He's always going to be Todd from Boogie Nights. And every actor and actress who was in The Wire, I always call them by their character names.
Stringer Bell.
Stringer Bell. I don't care how hot he is, and he may end up being James Bond. He's Stringer Bell.
Omar Little.
Omar.
Call Jimmy McNulty.
That's right. McNulty. Bunk. All those dudes, man.
Bunk.
Bunk, who was also great in Tremé. As Bunk. He did not play Bunk. I'm sorry. Okay. Texts coming in here. We're talking about really, really scary books. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. It is Thursday. We're wrapping up Triple Play Thursday with a double play.
Yeah!
And there you go. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on 720 WGN. In honor of It Chapter 2 being released this weekend, we were talking about great fun facts about classic horror movies and some of your favorites, and then we moved on to books. What are the most terrifying books that you've ever read? We were Talking about Shirley Jackson's Haunting of Hill House, the one that I love by Shirley Jackson, which I've read several times, is We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which is a really fantastic book. And they made a really good movie out of it a couple of years ago with Tisa Formiga, Crispin Glover's in it, Alexandria Daddario. It's actually really well done. And it was from this year, I think earlier this year. I think it was, because I saw it on, I think it was on Netflix, if I'm not mistaken.
It's called We Have Always Lived in the Castle?
We Have Always Lived in the Castle, yeah, based on the Shirley Jackson book. And they did a nice job with it. And but yeah, I mean, I saw it, I guess if it wasn't Netflix, then I saw it on VOD.
Yeah, it came out last year. It's from 2018.
Okay.
And yeah, I'm trying to see where it was released here.
If it got a theatrical release, and then I think it probably was one of those movies, because I know I watched it just in my house.
Yeah, it was probably VOD
because
or something.
It was one of those movies that came out in the theaters, you know, in select theaters and on VOD on the same time. And I really liked it. And I'm very picky about that book because I love that book. And they did a very nice job with it.
Well, yeah, and then Netflix has scored a massive hit with Haunting of Hill House, the series.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Nick, Tom, and everyone, the picture of Dorian Gray, Oscar Wilde, relatively short, but may leave one with a lingering, disturbed feeling. That's from Sue. I read Picture of Dorian Gray. And at Flashback Convention, the lovely Virginia Madsen, during the Rich Coe's 40th anniversary Svengoolie celebration, when she came and joined us on the stage, told this great story about how she mistakenly showed her young son the picture of Dorian Gray, and that the one moment when it flashes to color and the face is so distorted, it scared the crap out of her kid, and she felt really terrible about it. The Hot Zone, based on a true story in various areas. They made a movie out of that, too, if I'm not mistaken. The book Deliver Us from Evil is very scary, but the movie stunk. No, if it's the same Deliver Us from Evil that I can't remember who's in it, but it was a bad movie. 312 area code says Stephen King's books are great. I've read almost all of them. Not a fan of his movies for the most part. None of them hold up to the books, just my opinion. 224 area code says Sybil was a very scary book. I loved it. We've talked about this in the past, a lot of Stephen King books out there, a lot of Stephen King stories, but we've all talked about this, about how scary, and we got a couple of texts about this too, how scary Pet Sematary is.
Yeah, Pet Sematary is probably overall one of his most disturbing.
Oh, I think it's the scariest thing he's ever written. And he thinks so too, because, you know, in interviews, he's like, he would stop writing and just go, what am I doing? what am I writing? It's not the scariest movie or slash movies. I think it's definitely the scariest book he's ever written.
I will say one that I've always wanted to kind of find was under his, it was written under his pseudonym, Richard Bachman.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if you can get it anymore. Because it was pulled from shelves shortly after it was published. Rage.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because of the Columbine shooting.
Yeah.
But I've always been curious to read it because it's one of those forbidden things.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can even get it. Yeah. I don't even know if it's in print.
One of the other books, some of the other ones that they mentioned here, we need to talk about Kevin by Lionel Shriver, which was turned into a fantastic movie. Night Film by Marisha Pessel. Pen Pal by Dathan Auerbach. These are some that they mentioned here in the most terrifying book. We have The Girl Next Door by Jack Ketchum. Jack Ketchum is a great writer. Great horror writer. Here's what they say about The Girl Next Door. The horror often pivots on the corruption or warping of societal norms and rules. Once you feel like you can't rely on the natural source or social order, literally anything is possible. Ketchum's disturbing novel about an unimaginable abuse suffered by two sisters when they are forced to live with their mentally unstable aunt and her three savage sons is based on real events, but it's the central theme of an adult giving official sanction to atrocities that makes this story so utterly horrifying. Jack Ketchum wrote the book that The Woman is based on, the Lucky McGee film, which is a great movie. And they too mentioned Pet Sematary. So Stephen King's of several of King's books could be on the list, but he frequently blunts the terror of his stories with the richness of humanity in his characterizations and the sprawl of his narratives. Pet Sematary manages to be his most terrifying novel by dint of its simple, devastating concept, a magical cemetery where buried things come back to sort of life, but aren't quite what they once were. From the simple idea, the King ramps up the climax that gets under your skin in a fundamental way that most horror stories fail to do. Blood Meridian by Carmack McCarthy.
Oh God!
Yeah,
it's horrific.
And he's not known for his happy stories.
Yeah, no, The Road doesn't exactly end super well.
No,
nor does No Country for Old Men.
No. Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury. Great book, and turned it into a great movie. A great movie. Early 80s, I want to say 82, 83. Jonathan Pryce is in it. It's about childhood and adulthood, and it's a really, really, and it captured Bradbury's sense, his sense of humor and his style and everything, like his themes, his common themes. And I just remember really digging the movie a lot. Haunted by Chuck Palahniuk. Oh man. Told in alternating chapters to depict a group of aspiring writers voluntarily secluded in an unusual writer's retreat and their stories with the stories that they're writing. Haunted not only contains one of the most disturbing short stories ever published, Guts, which caused several people to faint when Palahniuk read it in public. Have you read that? You've not read Guts?
No, the only Palahniuk stuff I've ever read was Fight Club and Choke.
Read Choke as well. It's also a deep dive into madness as the reality TV obsessed characters start sabotaging their experiment in a quest for fame. Guts is I can't really describe it, but it involves a person who is stuck on a swimming pool vent.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, ew.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it gets...
So that's what that is.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And it's the description of what happens to this person.
I think I might just go the rest of my life having never read that.
It's,
I think I'll just let it...
And it does... I mean, people were passing out when he would read it.
I imagine.
And I've read it and was like... Ugh. And then finally, Beloved by Toni Morrison. A really, really terrific book. And I love the movie. I know people hate the movie. Jonathan Demme with Oprah, Danny Glover. And I think it's a great movie. I thought it was great and really scary. I think Beloved is a very scary movie. Mm-hmm. Very scary.
And I can't believe we've lost Tony,
Yeah.
Tony this year.
Yep. All right, we're going to break here. Hey, tomorrow is Friday, so Fly Jams Friday. All the regular Friday features will be happening. And we're going to get our visit here from Rick Geezer. Football season, obviously, unless you live under a rock, it begins tonight at Soldier Field. So we are going to do a football version of Sports Songs with Rick Geezer. He'll be live in studio, and then all the regular Friday features.